grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody. Welcome to episode 341 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Mind blown that we are within 10 episodes of actively becoming Curious Realm. I cannot thank all of you enough for your many, many years of support of this show, of our mission, of everything that we do, because folks like you are what make it happen. Folks like you are what make this conversation happen. Folks like you are what keep me motivated. Keep me motivated not only in this show, but in our online group on Facebook, everything. So this is for you guys. These applause. I'd also like to thank all of y'all for voting for us in the People's Choice Podcast Awards. That awards ceremony just happened. I have not heard word yet, but we were up against some high competition in the news and politics category. This was the first time that we'd ever been nominated for an award. We were very, very pleased to have been nominated and very, very honored that so many of y'all went and voted for us in the finals, things like that. I should be hearing word any day now as to whether or not we won that in the news and politics category in the Adam Curry Podcast Awards. So very excited to find out. I cannot wait. What an incredible, incredible honor on the way out the door as Dudes and Beer, and on the way in the door as the Curious Realm. And speaking of the Curious Realm and you guys and the power you have and the sway you hold over the interweb, because of you guys, here in the last month and a half, 2 months of us having the social media call to action and the show call to action to simply Google Curious Realm, we have taken over Google. We are now officially everything but two results on the front page of Google whenever you Google Curious Realm. So you guys did that. You guys made that happen. I can't thank you enough. That Wolverine yell is for y'all. So, man, our guest tonight, so incredible. Here recently, I have been back on the road with work, hence all the pre-recorded episodes. See, before COVID, our live episodes on the road didn't necessarily stop when I was on the road. Occasionally, if I knew that my work was going to take me beyond the starting time of the show, frequently I work night shifts, things like that, leading breakouts at conferences. And because of that, some of our shows in the past were pre-recorded, but now, because over COVID, we've started producing video, we've started doing the show in this format. I'm trying to do all shows pre-recorded whenever I'm on the road to assure the fact that we bring the same kind of production, to assure the fact that we have the proper internet connection to be able to look at the internet while we're going live, while we're recording live anyway. Because this show is unedited. There's never any hard edits in this show. I don't really believe in editing people's messages when it comes to the talk, the conversations that we have on this show. It can very easily be manipulated that way, and you can very easily, with B-roll cuts and stuff like that, covering things up, make people say almost anything they want, anything you want, rather. So I go with an unedited radio-style show. I don't edit. It's not for any point of laziness. It's for a point of honesty. If there are technical issues, like even tonight, there's a technical issue with our guest, Terry Lovelace. Now, tonight is a fireside chat. It's super great. 3 hours long. We have two guests. First guest up is the amazing Chong Kim, author of the book Broken Silence, survivor of human trafficking. She's been on the show a couple times before. She was on the show whenever Epstein got jailed. We will be talking to her tonight about her new book, Broken Silence, as well as her ongoing mission against human trafficking, as well as the difference between human trafficking and smuggling, coyotes, things like that. Very fine line legal differences, but also some very, very scary stuff when you're talking about victims' rights wrapped up in there. So we're going to be getting into all that with her in the first part of the show. And in the second part of the show, the technical issue I was telling you about, it was weird, folks. We had Terry Lovelace. Oh, that's the back of a book. We had Terry Lovelace on the show numerous times about Incident at Devil's Den. We had a chance to sit down with him in person, hence the fireside chat style this time around. There won't be any interruptions of video. There won't be any graphics being shown. It's simply us sitting in a hotel room having a conversation. But what was interesting is when Terry showed up beforehand, the TV randomly just turned itself on. Like, while we were just sitting there having a drink of scotch, hanging out in the hotel room and chatting and getting microphones on, all that, the TV just turned itself on with the remote control all the way across the room. And then randomly, my audio device on Terry, though it was working, afterward, was completely, and I mean disabled, like bricked for no good reason. A brand new device. I've recovered it and everything else, but I was not able to recover the audio off of it. So the audio that you will be hearing is, you know, a little bit panty, stuff like that. But we did some great treatment on it, came out great, fantastic interview. I cannot wait to get to these tonight. Once again, folks, I can't thank you enough for everything that you have done for this show, for the cause, for the community, for everything that we do. It's all because of you guys. It all happens because of you guys. So even the Dudes and Beer group, this last week I had a chance to hang out with Andy McDearman on the road. And while we were just sitting there having a beer, he was like, you know, what's really cool is, like, sometimes in the group, it's almost like the content of the show comes from the group. And I was like, you know, what's funny is that's why I started the group. Sometimes it's a little bit hard for me to gauge what 500-600 people in a Facebook group want to listen to. However, if I start throwing articles up and people start responding to articles, and there are some articles that have numerous threads going on and threads for days, hey, those are things I try to have shows on. So, yeah, go out there. Be involved with the group. Comment. Be nice. Be kind. Be open-hearted, open-minded, folks. We all believe different things for different reasons. Does not make our belief invalid. With that in mind, let's get to our first guest here. Chong Kim, survivor of human trafficking and author of the book Broken Silence. Right after this. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies. Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is podcastcadet.com.
Proud to have guests like you on. Our guest today is Chong Kim. She is the author of Broken Silence. She is the inspiration for, God, so many different movie parts, so many different stories that are out there involved in the world of human trafficking. Before we get into the book, before we get into everything else that you've been up to recently, give us a little bit of your history, Chong, and what you've been through and exactly what human trafficking is. Because like we talk about with Billy Joe Kane regularly, I think a lot of people confuse smuggling with trafficking, and especially confuse things like coyotes or, you know, basically smuggling people with permission. Mm-hmm. But let's get into what human trafficking is and how you came to be ensnared in such a horrible, horrible realm.
Absolutely. So first I want to explain what is human trafficking and what is human smuggling.
Yeah.
And my personal opinion about human smuggling as well. So human trafficking is by force, fraud, coercion, taking any person for a purchase to make money, to make profit for sex, for labor, child drug mules, organ trafficking, and now they have updated to infertility trafficking. It's already happening in Russia, in China, and it may come here in the United States, and I'll talk about the infertility trafficking.
Wow.
So anyways, basically these people do not have a choice. Whether through manipulation, force, fraud, coercion, they don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Whereas human smuggling, so let's say I'm actually in North Korea and you're a Chinese person. I'm going to pay you to help me get across to reach to South Korea mm-hmm. so I can be safe. That is human smuggling. And so that is considered a crime. When you're putting people in your car to transport them through different countries with their permission, you're not buying them. As soon as the transaction ends and he takes me to my destination, then we're good to go. The reason why I brought up earlier that I said I'm going to bring up my opinion about human smuggling, because there's been a crossover where human smugglers turn into traffickers.
Yeah.
They also manipulate some of the families. So let's say I have a daughter that I want her to go to America. So I hire you to smuggle my daughter, who may be anywhere between 6 years old all the way up to 17 years old.
Yeah.
I hire him. He takes my daughter to overseas, bring her to the United States. All of us will be penalized, and all of us will be convicted for human smuggling, including my daughter, who did not have a choice. Let me repeat that. She did not have a choice. I made the decision for her. Even though she's my daughter, she'll go along with whatever I say. So that's also coercion and also fraud. And that's what's happening on our borders. And that's the thing that people, that we need to change and educate our system.
Yeah.
There was a victim, and I'm not going to say her name. She was actually hired, her parents hired a coyote to smuggle her into the United States. The smugglers then turned into trafficker and sold her for sex, pregnated her, sold her children. And guess what? The federal government have already told me, and I spoke to five, they refuse to intervene because they see that as straight up human smuggling. But if this girl did not have a choice,
wow,
then what's the use of having a definition of human trafficking?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she didn't have a choice. Her mother did. Yeah. Her mother needs to be penalized. But what about this girl?
Yeah.
And she's now having to hide because the traffickers are still looking for her because the federal government refused to go after them.
Well, and the sicker thing is the fact that she's actually guilty of a crime. Yes, guilty of a crime because she was a part of the smuggling to begin with. But she's not part of the trafficking.
No.
She's not part of that.
Exactly.
But she's wrapped up in it.
Exactly. Because the smugglers turned into traffickers.
Yeah, yeah.
So then the case turns.
Yeah.
And it needs to be looked at as a trafficking since that's the most recent violent thing that happened to her. But the federal government refused to reopen the case. I had to find a private attorney to take her case.
Yeah. And at that point, the offender becomes a victim.
Yep.
At that point. And the table should be turned on the other people as
well. Exactly.
And the fact that they, that's just mind-numbing to me. Like, I've seen injustices in the judicial system, things like that. But to know that definition twist could even happen, and that the person being trafficked could actually become a further victim of the legal system.
Yep.
It's horrifying.
It is.
And is this a situation? Now, let's get into real quick, because a lot of our listeners, I mean, we've grown an audience since last time you were on.
Yeah.
But let's get into a little bit of how you came to be actively trafficked yourself and how you came out of that.
Okay. I actually met a guy that I fell in love with. I was smitten by him. He was wearing a Marine uniform. He was, and now I'm learning all the terminology like love bombing. He was a narcissist, you know, all this other stuff. He told me I was beautiful. I had low self-esteem. I didn't think I was beautiful. And plus, you know, this had a lot to do with it growing up in a country small town in Oklahoma, and I was the only Asian. When you have white kids, they're like, ew, she sat next to you. Shh. And I'm like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, and you have boys that are like, ew, you're a chink or a gook, and I don't want to date you. So I thought nobody was ever going to date me.
Yeah.
The Asian men didn't like me because I was too loud and rambunctious. And I felt like, oh, the American men doesn't like me because I don't look like them.
Yeah.
And so when I met Keith, that was his name, the recruiter, he was like, you are beautiful. And I was like, really? I mean, I believed every word he said. I believed every line. And it was, to me, it was like that fairy tale romance that you hear about. And those aren't true. There is a difference of real love and fairy tale love.
Sure, sure.
And we dated for 2 weeks. I was in love. I remember writing in my notebook his name, my name, and his last name, you know. And so I didn't recognize red flags. I was not aware of what red flags.
And how old were you at this point?
I was 19.
19.
Yes.
Okay. And how old was he, at least to your knowledge?
26.
26 to your knowledge.
Yes.
Was he actively older than that? Or was he really 26?
I just have to say, between 26 to 32, he looked very good.
Sure. Honest if nothing.
He looked like one of those soap opera guys that were very built, you know,
sure, sure.
And had that chiseled chin and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, he's too pretty to
date and I mean, of course, you know, at 19, I mean, hey, myself as a man at 19, we all have a bit of naivete at 19. So it can be very easily, like you said, to be swooned and swooped off your feet.
Yep.
But, was it reality, the fact that he was or ever was a Marine?
No.
Or no?
He never was a Marine.
And let's start getting into that, because I think that's really important for a lot of young women to understand. And it sounds horrible to say, but the ease with which one can be so deeply deceived.
Yes. So Keith was never a Marine, but he wore a Marine dress uniform that he bought from the Army surplus store.
Great place to buy one.
Exactly. And there are other traffickers that have been known to buy police uniforms, firefighter uniforms. So basically, anybody with uniform, ask for badge number, get a selfie.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to make sure I got your badge number. But I never knew that. I didn't know until later on that he was never a Marine. I didn't find this out until after I became a madam, I heard about his name and everything, and I found out everything was a setup. And I was like, wow. But to get back into the recruiter, he groomed me, basically. He groomed me. And he would tell me he went to take care of me. He was in love with me. And then he said, I want to take you to go meet my parents. I was ecstatic. Because that meant when a guy introduced you to his parents, it means he's thinking something serious.
Sure.
And this was within 2 weeks of knowing him, though. And I didn't know that wasn't healthy.
Not a typical time to go meet mom.
Exactly.
You hope by date three. It's not like, come on by the house. I got to change mom's litter. It'll just be 30 minutes, I promise. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, no, you're fine. So from that point on, I remember sitting in a car the first day that my life was going to change. I remember looking out the window and seeing the trees pass by, watching the sun start slowly going down. And I would envision like the picket fence and all that stuff.
Yeah.
By the time we got to this abandoned house, it was all boarded up. And I have to be honest, the first thing in my mind was like, I hope his mom doesn't live here. Because I really don't want to visit.
God, I hope he treats his mom better than this.
Yes. So I was like, does your parents live here? And he was like, no, I have a homeless friend. And of course, my naivety, I was like, oh my gosh, not only is he handsome, but he cares. And so I was like, I'll sit in the car. And I said, I'll sit in the car and I'll wait for you. That's when everything changed. He got out of the car, walked over to the passenger side, opened the door. I remember looking up and he choked me. And he whispered in my ear. And my first thought was, what did I do? Is it my fault? I want to make him happy. Why is he mean to me? I want to make him smile. I want him to love me again.
Wow.
Those went through my mind. It wasn't like, oh, how dare he put his hand on me. I'm going to beat him upside the head.
And now, and granted, cultural differences, because you did grow up in another country entirely until early in life.
No, I was only born in South Korea.
Oh, okay.
I came here as a baby.
So, oh, okay. I thought it was like 4 or 5 for some reason.
No, age 3 to 6, okay. I was raped. And then my parents basically raised me, but with that cultural thing.
Yeah.
They're like, you're Korean, you have to act like this.
Because what was it, do you think, now that made you immediately go into
that pleasing?
That victim mode almost, of like, what did I do?
Mm-hmm. It was from my childhood. My mother had beat me. And because I was the oldest, my mom always says, you're the oldest, you have to take all the blame. You're the oldest, you have to please people. It became a cultural thing.
Yeah, you have to be the example.
Exactly.
Whether it be in discipline.
Exactly.
Or what, you're going to get disciplined harder so that the others don't make that mistake.
Exactly. And then I remember always having to apologize, even for things I didn't do. My sister would do something and I'd be like, I'm sorry. They're like, then go clean it up. Even though my sisters were over there doing it and I didn't do it, I still had to go and clean it because I was the oldest. Mm. It was about obedience and honor, which is all bullshit.
How Western of you.
I know. That's why Korea don't want me to come back. She's going to bring on the Women's Alliance in Korea. Like, we don't want to cook sushi, damn it.
Wow. You heard it here first.
Yes. But, and I want people to know, the reason why I'm laughing and everything, it's been over 20 years. I was in traffic yesterday, otherwise I'd be a blubber ball.
Well, it's quite literally the morbid sense of humor about the horrifying things that have happened in your life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, but one of the things that I will never forget, when I was sold, so I'm going to kind of fast forward here because you're going to have to read the book to read the rest of this stuff. But from Keith, then there was a madam. The madam was involved. And then she was the one that actually trafficked me because I had called the police on a rape that happened by an escort.
Mm.
And so they had to get rid of me. So she tells me about escort service. I didn't know what an escort service was. You know, it's not like a dinner table topic at your family's dinner table. So who wants to be an escort someday? You know, anybody? Mm. You know? And so I remember she said, you can make a lot of money. And I said, do I need to have sex? She's like, no, we don't do that. I found that to be a lie. And because Keith had destroyed my documents, my driver's license, my citizenship papers, I couldn't go to shelters. I couldn't get housing. I couldn't get anything. And then, so when the madam intervened, she was the one who trafficked me. So I remember meeting them at a parking lot in somewhere in downtown Oklahoma City. But there was a construction over here. There was, I remember, a fence, but it was so far away. It looked like a football field, the parking lot.
Oh, wow.
That's how big the empty parking lot was. I remember seeing, it looked like either a Chevy Blazer, but it looked like an Explorer or something back in the 90s. And they had turned around and pulled in from the back. And I remember he pulled the door up. It was opening up this way. And I remember feeling my heartbeat. And because I was born disabled, and I'll explain a little bit about that, I thought there's no way I can limp myself out of here. So the only thing I thought at that time is I'm just going to have to let them take me. I don't have a choice. Yeah. I can't limp my way. They're going to shoot me. I was more afraid of being shot than them taking me. So they bound my wrist, they put blindfold, and they put a potato sack over me. And I was laying on the floor of the bed, and I remember hearing them two men talk, and it didn't sound American. It was European. So I didn't know. I was like, am I going to a different country? I remember when we finally made our stop, it felt like 2-3 days drive. And I did not know they were taking me from Oklahoma to northern Nevada on an Indian reservation.
Oh, wow.
And on this Indian reservation was a warehouse. And so they also had connecting warehouse to the casinos. And so, I mean, not warehouse, but underground basements. So anyway, when I was at this facility, I actually thought we were in a third world country. I didn't think about planes. I didn't think about boats.
Yeah.
You know, you don't think about those things at the time. You're just like, what the F? What is this here?
Yeah.
And I was still blindfolded. And I remember hearing their voice bounce off the wall, this cement wall. And I remember hearing the keys rattle, the doors rolled up. And when it rolled up, I remember hearing, and I was like, wait, that's not me. Because I was feeling my face, like, did I sneeze?
You know? Yeah.
And so they pushed me in, and I could feel, like, you can feel bodies. You knew there was other people near you.
Wow.
So when they pushed me in, they pulled the potato sack off. The moment they pulled the blinds, I saw about between 20 to 50 girls, and they were lined up like this, standing like this. They were like, looking down. And he said, this is your new home. Shut the door. And I turned around and I was slamming my hand on the door.
Yeah.
And as soon as the door shut, I saw the girls' demeanors change. They were like, from here to. And I was like, we need to scream. And they all just kind of looked at me and I was like, And these were all different races. We were all clumped together. So it wasn't just one race. It was, we were all mixed up, but all of these girls didn't speak English. It's like each one of us came from a different country.
Mm.
And so they were pulling we had like these mattresses lined up on the wall. They would pull the mattress down, bring it on the floor, and we'd all sleep on the floor. And I remember when I was smelling, I was like, what is that smell? It was old urine, old vomit, blood from their period, all of that. I mean, it was disgusting.
Wow.
I remember feeling sick. Some of the little girls got pneumonia. We don't think about these things.
Yeah.
You know, when we think someone's being held or someone's being abused, we don't think about the little micro things that take advantage of every day.
We do. And that's something that we talk about. We were talking before the show about our friend and guest, Billy Joe Kane, and his work in human trafficking. And his work started because his children got groomed. mm-hmm. by somebody that they knew.
Yep.
For years. And it was like, wow. And that's just it. I don't think that even in our modern day connected society, Chong, that people understand the readiness of this, the actual availability of this,
mm-hmm.
the fact that this is in every town.
Yep.
Like you hear about it sometimes whenever the Super Bowl happens, you'll always hear about like a major sting, something like that. The FBI will come in beforehand and catch some trafficking ring or something. But then it calms down. Like I follow the FBI, RSS feed, things like that. So I hear about it a lot more regularly than the average person.
Mm-hmm.
But this is everywhere. Mm-hmm. It is so entirely pervasive. It's like I just get chills thinking about it. I can't imagine having gone through it the way that you have and having come out on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
To the person that you are today.
Yes.
Like I said, it numbs my mind and brings me to a point of stymie to even think about how regular this is. It's horrifying. It's horrifying. When you start going through and looking at the research and start looking at the numbers, it is mind-numbing.
Mm-hmm. It is very not mind-numbing. And the other thing is what a lot of people don't understand. Every 40 seconds, a child or a youth goes missing. Every 40 seconds. That means before that 40 seconds, somebody was grooming them.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine every 40 seconds someone goes missing, just imagine how quick someone is grooming every second.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
Grooming or stalking. One of the two.
Yep.
Grooming or stalking. Grooming, stalking, or making a deal on the side somewhere.
Exactly.
You know, taking money for who has been groomed or stalked.
Yep.
And
it's a vicious cycle because the sad part, when I was trafficked, the one thing I want to emphasize, even some of the traffickers that had to watch us, they were being threatened by their families. A lot of them were undocumented persons as well.
Yeah.
But they had to do what they had to do in order to feed their family.
Yeah.
And even if they would never see them again, they had to make sure. Because traffickers know how to prey on the vulnerable and use the vulnerable to go against each other.
Yeah.
While they are hands off. Because I always tell people, it's like going to Best Buy.
Yeah.
Well, you never meet corporate. And those are traffickers.
Well, it's really more the fact of, psychologically anyway, I would think, Chong, mm-hmm. of rage shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you're dealing with the victim mentality and the fact of what did I do? What can I do?
Yep.
And that being confused and crosswired. And then you're having a room of 40 people that are confused and crosswired and going, wait, if they're doing and they're getting, that's what I need to do to be able to get.
Yep.
And almost like what happens with people where there are only 100 available TVs on Thanksgiving morning after, or on Black Friday after Thanksgiving morning, you know, where it's like, there's only 100 of these. What do I do to be the one to be able to get one?
Yep.
And I can't even imagine the hysterical mentality amongst that group of people to garner that attention at the same time.
Yep.
Like that desperate grab for attention amongst people.
And
like,
then,
that's...
And then the other thing that's... it was also a mind game for us because we didn't get to shower when we were being held. So when my movie... There was a movie about me called Eden. You can watch it on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
But one of the things I want to share with everyone... In the movie, we took showers. That did not happen in real life because traffickers needed us to beg for showers in order to comply to be sold.
Soon as you said that, it just popped in because after I interviewed you the first time, I watched Eden.
Yep.
And it just even dawned on me the blessed relief of getting to shower.
Yes. Because it's that one moment that you're alone.
And it's like, my God, like if that's what I have to do to get to shower after 2 weeks, fine.
Yep. Absolutely. Wow. Because I remember when the traffic guards would roll the door open, he said, who wants shower? First he would say, he would see us, you know, just lining up looking scared. Mm. So then he started mixing it up and he was like, who wants showers? Then the girls would run up.
Yeah.
And then he's like, good.
Wow. Because
they know what that means. Even the little girls would be like, I want shower.
Yeah.
Because if she doesn't get picked, she's never going to get a shower.
Yeah.
Because in the storage unit, even though we had mats, I want people to visualize this. And here's the other thing that I want to dispel the myth. You don't have to be held against your will to be trafficked either. And I'm getting sick and tired of people saying people who get held is not true. That you should not say, because I never got pimped out, so I'm never going to talk about pimping. So if you've never been held under, you need to keep your mouth shut. You know, that's how I say it.
Well,
because you're hurting victims that are being held against their will.
It's
you know?
And I think, sadly, Chong, that comes from a lot of people that don't understand Stockholm Syndrome.
Exactly.
That do not understand the fact that at some point you become so demoralized, so desensitized, that you cannot live without your captor.
Yep, absolutely.
That you can't even fathom
life without them. You can't life without imagine them. Breathing without
and,
them.
And this like goes that. This goes beyond, and this is not to discount any familial abuse that happens or spousal abuse that happens. But this goes beyond those cases that you see where it's like, why can't she just leave him?
Yep.
Why can't she just leave him?
Yep.
And be it the fact that she doesn't have a job, she's saddled with children, she, what have you.
Yep.
It goes beyond that.
It does.
Because it like you say, it goes to the point of the everyday, the regular. The blessed relief of just getting a shower. And if you don't understand that, folks, if you've ever spent what I have spent, literally, Chong, 14 hours behind bars once in my life and never again, ever again. And I will admit it, I am entirely too, like, vibrationally sensitive a person. Mm-hmm. Like, it hurt me inside to be there. And it hurt me more inside to be there for the people that I knew that were there for longer than what I was going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And the blessed relief of fresh air after 14 hours. And that was just to get into the transfer vehicle.
Yep.
That was just to get into the transfer vehicle, just to get into like the, in Houston, Texas in July, where it was like, wow, fresh air. Okay, now we're getting into the back of this 10-person steel van. This is great. No AC.
Exactly.
You know, even that was blessed relief.
Absolutely.
To get out into that. So I can't imagine what it would be like to live in that.
Because one of the things I learned through therapy when I went back to therapy, and there is no expiration to healing. So I want to point that out. There is no expiration to healing. So I get sick and tired when people say, well, it was that long ago and you're still, you know, going through it. Yes.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I want people to understand, when I wrote this book, I wanted people to know that my abuse happened the moment I was born. And so have you ever taken a pitcher of water and then poured different food color? And guess what it turns into? Black.
Yeah.
But if we were to take every food color out, would it still turn clear? So when you add on each food coloring is every trauma a child goes through.
Yeah.
So when the child has not healed, and it's stacked another trauma, another rape, another battering.
Yeah.
Then you get all the way up to here where trafficking starts. And so you either become one or two things. You either start to think, you know what? I'm going to play the game. I'm going to go along with this, and I'm going to get what's mine, and then you turn predator. Or you survive, you go through it, you start hating the world, start hating yourself, but slowly heal, and you become an overcomer.
How long did you hate yourself for your decision to follow him?
Oh.
How long? Because, I mean, as an addict myself and somebody who suffered with some pretty hard drug addiction at one point in my life, a lot of people ask me why I have a lot of the cold just cut off that mm-hmm. I do. And it's yep. because if I choose to care further than that, it may yep. not be a happy situation for me.
Exactly.
Because I just exactly. care too damn much. Yep. And I choose to make other people a project. In
yep.
life. And when they fail, I feel like I failed. And exactly. that's no good. And that's just my own. I haven't even been through what you've been through. But it's the fact of that was my decision. And it took me years to get over the fact that that was my decision and to literally understand, like you just said, that forgiveness, that healing.
Is a continuum.
It's a continuum. It's you don't get over you're it. Always working on.
Exactly. It. I'm still, my therapist says I'm in a love-hate relationship with my trafficker still. Mm. Even though I have been away from him physically. Because every time I speak, I didn't realize that some of the things reminisce that old feelings.
Yeah.
It's like, have yeah. you ever heard of a song and all the feelings come back? And you're like, oh yep. my gosh, it's just like yesterday yeah. I felt yeah. that. One thing I remember that made me fall in love with him, and he was not a very good looking guy. I mean, I'm like 19 years old.
Love has nothing to do with that. That's the thing, Chong. Is that's how I know that what was on your side was pure and right.
Yes.
Love has nothing to do with it.
No, but I thought I was in love.
Sure.
And that's where, because I'm recently learning about narcissism.
Love and infatuation.
Yes. Because I recently broke up with a boyfriend that was a narcissist. And I kept wanting to find, because I started seeing my track record in men. And I was like, I yeah. realized most of the men that were bad for me were just like my father. And I was like, where is this coming from? So my therapist says, your father was a narcissist. So I remember, as crazy as this may sound, I wanted my trafficker to be proud of me. I wanted him to be so proud.
Yeah.
So I said, guess what? I found a girl for you. And I remember I had this girl, she was sitting in the car, you know, she was 18 years old, she was a freshman at UCLA. We found these girls from Beverly Hills to UCLA.
How old were you at this point?
I was 20.
Wow, within a year.
I was already a madam.
Within a year. Wow.
And my trafficker trained me how to groom them, how to do this, how to do that. And so I remember having a Corvette. And it was either Corvette or Jaguar. So I would drive through the campus. You saw all the guys looking at you and you felt power. You know, you even see some of the women and some of the girls look at you. And I remember this one girl, she was walking and I pulled up and I was like, do you need a ride? And she just looked at me. She was like, okay. We didn't know each other because we were female. She trusted me.
Yeah.
And so I befriended her. I became her best friend. We were going out. We were hanging out. Because my trafficker says, good girl, this is how you do this. This is how you do that. And then find out her vulnerability. So she would invite me to her parents' home. I knew right then. Father was an alcoholic, beating on the wife. The wife still stays. She has a little brat brother. He's like 15 years old. And the mom, she looks at me. I'm wearing Daisy Dukes. I'm not even wearing a professional-looking outfit.
Yeah.
I'm wearing Daisy Dukes with go-go heels that were like 10 inch. I'm surprised I have not broken my neck since then. And I had these long eyelashes. I had glitter eyeshadow. I mean, I did not look like someone that could be going to campus.
No, you definitely looked like you just came from the club.
Right. And this was broad daylight. And I saw the dad. He's spanked my butt, and I played into it because my trafficker taught me how to do that. because we went to get good graces with the parents.
Yeah.
So that way, if their daughter becomes
missing,
because then
it's permission.
Bingo. So I didn't realize this until later on.
Wow.
And so I remember we would hang out and everything. And so I would get her drunk. I would get her high. You know, I would get her to snort cocaine with me. We would have these. So then I start pushing the envelope. Like, have you? Mm. I would start kissing her and see what she does. And she kissed me back. And I was like, okay, good. She likes me that way.
Yeah.
So then I would start bringing a guy in the bedroom, doing a threesome, seeing how she reacts. She didn't care. And she was like, I want to be with you, Julie. My name was Julie at the time. Mm. So I was known as Julie Castados. I was a madam. No one knew, ever knew me as Chong Kim. If you go up to them and say, do you know Chong Kim? They'll be like, who?
Yeah.
And so, but I will never forget, we became friends within a matter of weeks. It was like almost every single day I would pick her up from school, you know, and she's like, and when she was stressed out, she would look at her paper and she's like, oh my gosh. She was like, I have to come up with $1,000 for books. And I was like, here you go. I felt powerful.
Yeah.
And she was like, are you serious? And she would hug me and she would cry and everything. And I, every time I would feel a tinge of remorse or regret, guess why I pulled out that cocaine? All right. Back to the drawing board. This is business. This is business. Because the trafficker always said, never get attached to any other girls that you are bringing in. And so I said, okay, okay. I went to please him. It was all about him. It wasn't about, is this illegal? Because I never thought in my wildest dreams I would ever get out. I actually thought I was either going to die as a trafficked victim or as a madam. Or I was going to go to prison, or... both of those.
There's a reason why the term is called normalization.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because when you're addicted to anything, whether it's a behavior, a drug, a person, a way of life, it becomes a norm. And making those sacrifices or even doing those inhuman things, be it stealing, helping traffic somebody, bringing somebody into that world, becomes a norm.
Yep.
It becomes such a everyday passing thing that you don't even think twice about doing.
Exactly.
And I mean, granted, like I said, not to that extent, but I've definitely been there in my life. And I can understand that. It's not easy to forgive yourself from that point. And the fact that you have come to the point of even sharing your story, even helping other people, being involved within the trafficking community, the anti-trafficking community, anti-trafficking community. Those are the things that's why I don't edit my show. even that, it's huge. It's amazing. Because so many people would hide that light under a bushel, Chong. So many people would not embrace the mistakes they've made as a chance to help others and to help pull others out. And one of the passages from your book, I coiled myself down in front of her with as much grace as I could manage. My palms started to sweat. This was bad. I understood her rage. This cold, serpentine confrontation was all wrong. She leaned forward a little. Why did you say you wanted to kill somebody? She asked. How often did things like that happen with you? How often
with
did
me
things
and my
like
mom?
That? Yeah.
All
how,
the time.
How often was that echoed in your later life?
All the time. All the time. There are times I can still hear her voice. Like, if I... About a month ago, I decided to try dating again.
Okay.
And I actually cried because the guy said, you're fat. I've never seen a fat Asian. And I could hear my mom saying, see, you shouldn't have gone on a date. You're stupid. You're ugly. No one's going to want you. And then I started realizing, like, in the jewel, because I have this dissociative identity disorder now. So the jewels part of me that was trafficked, she's still in me. So the jewel part of me says,
yeah,
this is
no, because that's a switch that you had to turn on to literally disassociate from the real world.
So the jewels part of me comes out and says, this is why we need to get in shape. This is why you need to look hot. So you can tell this MF that he can go F himself. You will have that authority and that power. But my fear in losing weight for the longest time is I didn't want men to look at me. So it's kind of like a conflict.
Yeah.
On one hand, I want to be loved and cherished. But on the other hand, I didn't want to be idolized as just a piece of meat. I didn't want a guy saying, hey, I'll help you out if you give me this. Yeah. I'll help you out if you do this. I'm sick and tired of those. And so I started gaining weight. Because when I was thin and I could wear a two-piece, I had the flatboard stomach, you know, and everything. I was the stereotypical Asian fantasy
Cocaine helps with that.
Yes. It definitely helped. Then when I quit, all of a sudden I'm starting inflating, and I'm like, what happened here? But I remember gaining weight when I was married to my ex-husband because I had to have hip surgery. I was 130 pounds at the time.
Wow.
And my ex-husband kept pinching my sides. And I was like, what are you doing? He was like, you're getting fat. You're getting fat.
Wow.
So I was like, you know what?
Wow.
F you.
Yeah.
And so I started eating fried chicken, McDonald's. I just didn't care.
Good for you.
So I started bloating up. And then after that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to be like Lizzo. Who cares? I'm fine when I'm big. You know, now this Asian got butt. Because now I've been having people say, you got butt. And I was like, yeah, because I gained it. I earned this. But now that I've gotten older, I was asking my mom the other day. I said, did you hit your midlife crisis? And my mom's like, what the hell is that? You know that you hear about people hitting their midlife crisis. Sure. I'm 46. I'm not ashamed to say my age. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm getting older, so I don't have that youthful look that I used to have in my 20s and 30s. So does that mean that I'm going to be by myself for the rest of my life? On top of that, I have a disability. Who's going to change my diaper? Who can I be vulnerable for?
Yeah.
You know? And then on top of that, the last guy that I dated, I put all my hopes and dreams in him. I loved him so much because I thought he loved me. Mm-hmm. I invested $15,000 into his business. Nothing ever came about because he never did anything. And then one day, 5 days after my birthday, he says, I don't want to be with you anymore. And it crushed me.
Wow.
And so I've never been this emotional on a podcast.
That's okay.
But I cried for 2 weeks straight.
Yeah.
I just turned on the shower and just bawled my eyes out. And then after 2 weeks, I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I said, no, that's not the last of him. So then I started looking for apartments. Guess what? I got my own apartment.
Nice.
Then after that, I got a job. Then after that, I got a car. I did it all by myself. And then I started feeling empty, and I was like, okay, I got everything. So what the F is wrong with me? Why am I still thinking about this idiot that broke my heart, that tore everything away? So that's when I called behavioral health. I said, I'm a survivor of human trafficking. They're like, oh my gosh, they start singing 911. I was like, I didn't say I was trafficked. I said, I'm a survivor.
Yeah.
You know, and because the cop lady, when she came up, looked at me, she goes, you're the traffic victim? And I was like, I was trafficked. I was about to say, you look kind of old. And I was like, old people can be trafficked too. And I was like, it's not just little kids.
Thanks.
Right?
Yeah.
Like labor trafficking, organ
trafficking.
Yeah, thanks
for not understanding your job at all.
Right?
God.
So I ended up going to behavioral health, and I remember meeting my caseworker, and his name is the same name as my ex. And he was like, and when I was talking to him, he said, he's a narcissist. And I was like, no, no, he doesn't put a bunch of selfies. That's what I thought what a narcissist was. Yeah. I was like, he doesn't put a bunch of selfies. He actually is actually camera shy. And he's like, no. He's like, that's not a narcissist. That's just on the surface Hollywood version.
Yeah.
And I was like, so what are narcissists? So he told me, watch these videos. So I started watching them, and I was like, oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, he gaslighted me, he love bombed me, he trauma bonded me, and I'm bonded by the stupid trauma. And so then we started diving in more into my therapy, because in the past therapy I went through, I never got to talk about my parents. Everybody was so enthused about my trafficking that we forgot the most important part. So when I realized that my father and mother were both narcissists, and that's what made, because as a child you're developing, you start to look at their behaviors as normal. And then I realized not only were they narcissists, but so was my recruiter, who was also a narcissist. He loved to bomb me in the beginning and then switch up without a blink of an eye to traffic me.
Yeah.
And then my trafficker was a narcissist. He was the longest running narcissist intimate relationship I was with. He was very cold and stiff, but when I saw his vulnerable moments, I thought that was love. I thought, finally, he's sharing with me. He's going to be nice to me.
Yeah.
And, I started learning about all these men that were bad for me were narcissists. And so my therapist said to me, he said, if you want to get over him fast, find another man. But if you want to get over him completely, find yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm fucked. I'm like, it took me years to figure out that I was a victim of human trafficking. And now I got to fix myself. And then I said, you know, and I told my therapist, I said, you know what, the part that really is unfair, and I'm going to have a conversation with God. Why is it that
I can tell you about conversations with God. Now that's going to go. Go ahead, though.
So, why is it that when people have been abused, we're the ones who have to go the extra mile to fix everything? Why do we have to do all the work? You know, when, because I told my therapist, I said, I want to tell my ex-boyfriend that he hurt me. He said, it won't work. Trying to tell a narcissist how you feel, they're not going to feel remorse. They're not going to, if they apologize, they're only apologizing to shut you up. And I was like, so I can't let him know how much he hurt me? He said, you can, but he either won't respond. So if you want to write him, then don't expect a response. So in June of this year, I sent my ex a long email. And told him, this is how I feel. I'm angry and I'm hurt. I'm angry because you knew I was trafficked and you exploited me.
Yeah.
You taunted my pain and my triggers. You made a laughingstock. Even though I was crying, you ignored my tears. I'm angry because I love you. I still love you. But I love myself more to not allow you to hurt me. And after I got done, I was like, is this where I'm supposed to feel empowered somehow? Because I really don't. I'm like, this sucks. And so, but then my friends told me that they noticed a change in me. They knew I was in a relationship, but they didn't know, was it COVID or was it the relationship?
Yeah.
And I said, what do you mean? They said, Chong, you used to post tons of stuff about human trafficking.
Yeah.
I would have motivational Mondays, topic Tuesdays.
You did.
Yep. Yeah. Ever since I got in a relationship with an idiot, all of a sudden it stopped. And when I started learning about narcissism, what they take away from you, you know, I was like, that's what the trafficker did.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but anyway, I don't want to go too much on a tangent.
No, because it's about purpose.
Yes.
Chong, and, you know, I think that's a lot of the reason why you've written the book.
Yes.
Because before the book, you were, once again, the inspiration for movies, all kinds of stuff. numerous characters were based upon your story.
Yes.
But I think writing the book has really given you a new voice for yourself.
Yes.
And I think that's what your therapist is trying to say. The one thing that I learned through my years of therapy and things like that was that the whole Jerry Maguire, you complete me thing is great for a movie.
Yeah.
It's not actual real life.
Nope.
If you're depending on somebody to complete you, you yep. put a lot of burden on somebody else for a responsibility that is utterly your own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to go back to when you said that it was admirable of me to share even the darkest moments.
Yeah.
You know, me being a female trafficker. So I want to rewind that back. When I first started speaking, I started sharing that I, because someone said, well, how did you leave?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't leave and say, okay, bye. You know, now that you're done with me, I had to rank up because they don't let you leave.
Yeah.
I had to rank up.
Yeah, in you order basically to... had to rank up to rank out.
Exactly. So when I did that, I remember this girl, she walked up on stage. She spit in my face. She said, how dare you? You disgust me. When she did that, in my mind, I was like, I'm never going to tell anymore. I'm never going to speak about wow. this. Until the FBI agents start calling me. So 2 weeks later, the FBI agents, they contacted me. They're like, wait, we're with the FBI. And I was like, damn it. I knew if I said it, I was going to send my butt to prison. And so they said, can you come to the office?
Yeah.
And I was like, great. So this was in Minneapolis. I used to live in Minneapolis. So I went to the BCU. That's their Bureau of Criminal Investigation. And I remember this one FBI agent, she walked up to me and she was like, can I give you a hug? And I was like, before I go to prison? And she was like, what? And I was like, nothing. Sure, let's hug it out. You know, so we were hugging and she was like, I saw you speak 3 months ago. And I was like, oh, the one where I got spit on? She goes, yes, that girl doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. And I was like, oh, so I'm confused. And she was like, you can teach us
yeah.
how to get them because you've been there, not just on the victim side,
yeah.
but also on the other side.
Yeah.
You know the transits. You know the points, the sellers and buyers. And I didn't think about that at the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, let me guess. You want me to wear a wire? Act like a mama-san, and then you capture the traffickers, but they can still have guns and knives and things like that and still shoot and kill me. And because
before
I'm on
before you ever get there,
before I ever
yeah,
get
yeah,
there,
yeah.
and then on top
before
of that,
before you make the block,
right?
Sure.
I was like,
sure.
are you gonna cover my life insurance? And they're like, oh, yeah, well,
and you want me to pay for it through my taxes, right?
Right,
yeah, yeah. Just making
box.
Sure. Just making sure we got this all straight before we start.
Exactly. And that's when she was like, no, we want you to teach us. We want you to train us how they think.
Wow.
So I was like, I can get with that, which that didn't come on until later because this guy came in. He was like, no, we're going to have to have her do undercover. And I was like, so... They told me, they said, there's this, they flew me out to Miami. There was this Asian nightclub and they had like sex and guns and cocaine and everything. And so one FBI guy had to go with me. So I looked at him and I said, first of all, the FBI agent came in looking like a white version of Snoop Dogg. And I was like,
that's how you're undercover, you know.
I was like,
that is
all,
the sneakiest way to get in the club.
And I was like, I hate to burst your bubbles, but these Asian people don't like black people. So you trying to implicate a black character is not going to fly. And he
that's
was like,
really not going to be cool.
And I was like, they'll throw your ass out first before they'll make a conversation.
Yeah.
And he was like, but I was trying to act like a pimp. Yeah. And I was like, I was never with a pimp. So if you want me to teach you about trafficking, you need to dress up in a business attire.
Yeah.
Because I was wearing a three-piece suit. Yeah. Because I told the FBI, if I'm going to Miami, I was like, can I get some clothes? And they give me $100. You're going to have to give me $10,000. Because if I'm going to Miami and going to see a high-class Chinese, which they can be Mandarin or Cantonese, and they're like, can you speak those? No, but I'm going to improvise. And I said, you're going to have to get me a fly-ass suit. So one of the FBI agents, she had to go with me. And I was like, let's go to Macy's. And I was looking at three-piece suits and everything. And she was like, this is $500. Perfect! I love it.
Yeah.
And she was like, but our budget, you want me to play the part?
Yeah.
You got to follow the rules. You want me to teach you? We don't look like skimpy-ass girls with Mr. G-Dog that's a pimp. We don't walk in and go, yeah, I'll have that guy. It's going to be $200 for my booty. Yeah. No, that's not how the trafficking ring works.
Yeah.
And so I had to teach him. And so the guys, I was sitting at the bar, and I said, and he was following me, and I was like, will you quit following me? And he was like, well, I'm supposed to watch you. You can watch me from over there on the other side of the bar. And I had my phone face down, but I said, I'm calling you. He was like, why are you calling me? So you can hear our conversation. Because that was before we did voice memos and all that. Yeah. So this Asian guy came up to me, and he said, are you working? And I said, no, I own my own business. Because I wanted him to know that I was a mama-san. Mama-san means female pimp, for those of y'all don't know, in the Asian world. And so he was like, so what do you have to offer? So I had to speak in languages that he knew.
Sure.
So the FBI agent is like sitting with the phone trying to figure out, okay, she's saying she is a business owner. And I said, I do real estate. I also sell, I have a butcher shop. And he's like, okay, he said. And I said, and I recycle. He was like, those are pretty good businesses. But he didn't realize it was code words. And so he's like, how many new houses are under 13 years? And I was like, how young do you want them? How new do you want them? He said, a baby. He said, I want a brand new house, like a baby.
Wow.
And I said, that's kind of hard to come by, so you're going to have to give me a few days, but what are you offering? And he said, $400,000. And I said, for how long? He said, I want to keep her. I want to keep her and have sex with her. And by that time, I'm no longer a madam. I've been out of the life. So I'm like, I want to cry. I want to kill this man.
Yeah.
Whereas the old me was like, okay, let's do this transaction. I'm like, I'll be right back. I got to powder my nose. So I start walking to the bathroom and I'm puking my guts out. And I'm thinking to myself, where was I when the real transaction with the trafficker happened?
Yeah.
Why didn't I puke back then?
Mm.
And I forgot that I was already drugged up. I was already an addict. They had injected narcotics in my veins. So I didn't feel
anything.
Yeah,
or you were regularly numbing yourself with cocaine.
Yes.
What happened?
Heroin, sure. Narcotics, meth, you know. And so I had to look at myself in the mirror. And the FBI agent, he was standing outside the door. He was like, is everything okay? And I was like, oh my gosh, this guy is about to get on my nerves. He should not be following me because they watch you. And so by the time I got out, I said, I'll send you a contract, an NDA contract for the new housing, but you don't get to have her for 6 months. We're leasing her, and you're going to lease her for 1 month, $400,000. I'm sure you know how to make time with her. And he was like, I'll contact you and talk to my boss. And I was like, please do. And I gave him my card. So after we left, the FBI was still sitting there, and I walked out by myself. And I was like, that idiot is not listening to me.
Yeah.
So I walked in, grabbed his arm, and I was like, all right, now we can go because they're gone. And he was like, oh, I was still listening. And I was like, my phone wasn't on me at that time. And so we went back to the field office, and they're like, so what's going on? And I was like, he can't come with me. I can't have him come with me. He doesn't listen. He's not learning anything. And he had 4 margaritas. Is he allowed to drink? And they're like, typically know, but he can have like a drink here and there. And I was like, I wish somebody would have told me. I would have gotten me a stiff drink after that conversation. Yeah. And so they brought, so this woman, she was like, I want to follow her. She was the FBI and she goes, teach me everything. So I told her, it's better to have two women than a man. Because if they see a man following you and walking all over the club following you, they're going to be hands off. And he was like, well, I thought I was a business partner. They don't like to talk to men unless they already know you. If you're new, they're willing to talk to a female before they'll talk to a male. Mm. And I said, no offense. You're a white guy. They're Asian. They don't know you. And because I'm Asian, they think I'm going to keep quiet.
Yeah.
And so he was like, so the other woman, she was Colombian and Jamaican. And so I said, this is perfect. I'll just say you're one of my girls. And she's like, okay. And so we put makeup on her and everything like that. And then, so me and her were sitting at the bar and everything, and she was wearing a cocktail dress, and we had two Asians guy walk up to us. They're like, can I buy you a drink, ladies? And we're like, sure, and buy us a drink. And then we would watch our drinks, and then we would tell the bartender, can you give us a drink, just a glass? And so can you give us a bottle of beer? We wanted a bottle. So we would drink and spit in a bottle. We'd act like that was our chaser. That way we didn't drink anything just in case they roofed us or whatever. We'd sit and go, I'm going to have the chaser. And we would spit it in a bottle. And so that's how we did things. So that way we wouldn't be inebriated. We'd still be sober and everything. And so I was waiting for that guy that wanted an infant. He never came back.
Wow.
So I never got to fill out that transaction. But after I did so many of these undercover, then after a while, once my name got in the limelight, you know, my movie came out, then I had more and more FBI agents. And I told them, I said, I'm not doing undercover.
Yeah.
I will train your field agents how to do undercover. Send me the undercover agents. And so I looked at all of them. I said, I need a female girl that can look young. Like a minor, so we can set up a sting.
Yeah.
And I said, I got to hear her voice. She's got to sound young and things like that, so we can be able to. But now with the digital world, you know, now these predators can go on FaceApp. A guy can look like a little girl. I can look like a little boy and be friends on Fortnite with these kids, get their information, have virtual sex. And then groom them into my world.
Yeah.
Get them to want to talk to me more and more, because now that dopamine set in with whatever love bombing that the groomer gave to that child. Mm. And then one day she's going to be gone because she's going to follow me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember that TV series called The Following?
Yes.
With Kevin Bacon?
Mm-hmm.
But it was about the whole Edgar Allan Poe and serial killer.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually had a name for following because I went to talk about grooming and how these victims follow the groomer.
Yeah.
And I had the title Following, and I was like, well, now I can't use that title because Kevin Bacon has it. Great.
Well, and let's talk a minute about the book because, like I said, I'm a few chapters in, and I've definitely interviewed you a couple times before. What was it that brought you to finally writing the book? And getting this side of things done, because I think it's a big moment of transformation for you. Like I said, it's a big moment.
Well, when Eden Production Company contacted me the first time, I didn't have a book.
Yeah.
They said, Chong, we need your story. I sent them a one page. They're like, no, Chong, we need more. So I sent them five pages. So Rick Phillips, who was the scriptwriter, he called me up and he said, Chong, in order for us to do your film, we need to know every detail from what his sweat smelled like.
Yeah.
What did his pores, did his sweat drip on your forehead when he was on top of you? And I was like, are you serious?
Yeah.
And he said, yes, because the character who's playing you needs to also feel the heartbeat you felt, needs to feel that, you know, and I was like,
yeah, it's got to be visceral.
Yes. So I remember I started writing my story. it was just a manuscript. And there are times I called Rick Phillips. I was like, I don't want to do this movie. I changed my mind. This is too hard. I don't want to do this anymore. Now I hate everybody. Because the more I start writing, I was like, why am I writing this? Who am I empowering? They don't know me. I didn't know the amount of impact I had. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, who's going to listen to the little old Chong, you know? And so I remember Rick Phillips said to me, he said, Chong, you inspire me. If you can inspire one person, that's better than inspiring zero. And he said, that's why I want to do a film about your life. Yeah. And I was like, okay. So I rolled up my sleeve. That time I was dating this guy who's a great guy, by the way. But I was horrible. I started typing, writing my sorrows and everything. He's massaging. I was like, get away from me! I became the exorcist. And he was like, okay, okay. And I was like, I'm in a male-hating mood right now. He goes, all right.
All right.
Yeah. Should I bring some chocolate and flowers? And I was like, no, just leave me alone. He was like, okay. Yeah. So he stayed with his parents while I was knocking things out. However, I didn't know how to write a book. I was just rambling on and everything.
Sure, sure.
And I sent it over. And so he was just reading the notes, you know, and everything, and he put the script together. Now, I will say this much. The time the script got finished, I found out my dad had cancer. And so when he sent me the script, I was just skipping through the page. Yeah, it looks great. Go ahead, shoot.
Yeah.
So when I saw the movie, I was like, wait a minute, that part isn't true. And I was like, oh, dummy me. I didn't read the script line by line. I just went, it looks good. And so, but the part that I was hurt about in the movie was that I didn't get to be involved in the film as much as I wanted to. Sure. I didn't know anything about film, and all these producers were like, you can't be involved, you don't know anything about film.
Yeah.
So how are you going to tell my story? They're like, we got the script. So when I start reading the script the second time, I was like, okay, wait, oh crap, I'm in trouble now.
Yeah.
And so, but it became,
and at that point, things become an adaptation of.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then I had to go to red carpets and I was happy with South by Southwest.
Sure.
Because they said, we got Jamie Chung. And South by Southwest was like, so are you going to bring Chong? That's who we want. They were the first film festival to ask for me. They didn't care about Jamie Chung. They're like, she's an actress. We want to see the real woman.
Yeah, we want to see the person that it's based on.
Exactly. And so what I didn't know at the time, because I didn't have a manager, I didn't have an agent, I didn't have an attorney.
Yeah.
I did not know that the production crew treated me so bad that I went to start voicing what really happened to me.
Yeah.
And so, because people ask me, because in the movie, she kills people. I'm like, I don't want to go to jail.
I've never killed anyone.
Exactly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
And, you know, and that's just it. Often we see, like, this is based on true events. Story. You know, and you have to remember that a lot of licenses have probably been taken at that point.
Yes.
When you see this is based on true events. Like, unless it's the fact that quite literally, like a couple of Scorsese films, like Goodfellas, where the guy literally sat down with Martin Scorsese and told the story.
Exactly.
You know, based much more on what actually happened than what yours.
So what got me to write the book is that after the movie came out, after the red carpet, people were asking questions like, were there kittens? We even had people that were marching outside the theater, free the kitties, free the kitties.
Yeah.
And so shortly after I did, I had people come up to me, we love you, Chong. We think you're amazing. People were taking pictures. People I thought were true friends, they went to join along. But then whenever I needed help, it was like, it was quiet.
Yeah.
And then when I would text my friend like, hey, what's going on? Are you having another red carpet?
Yeah. Yeah, are you having another event? Are you?
And I was like, no, I just wanted to say hi. Yeah. And so shortly after that, the smear campaign came out.
Mm-hmm.
Jody Williams is a man that I knew. James Barnes actually owns his own escort service, but he fronts it with breaking out. I'm speaking out because I'm getting sick and tired of these smear campaigns.
Yeah.
And so everybody knew the version of Chong through Eden. They didn't know through my voice.
Yeah.
So I pulled out that script and I started hammering down every detail. I'm like, you know what? This is my turn. This is my voice. Now I've had it. I'm getting sick of this smear campaign of people who don't know me that wants to say, oh, you know what? I heard that this was fake, or I heard that she was a liar, or I heard that because her story all is mixed up. Well, first of all, I was drugged up. I don't remember whether it was 12 o'clock or was it 2 or was it
I'd
Thursday
or was it Monday?
I'd challenge
anybody to remember anything, you know, with any great detail 30
exactly.
years from now.
Exactly. You know, and so that became my push.
There's a reason why this testimony is not accepted in a court of law.
Exactly. And then on top of that, I've been working with the FBI agents.
Yeah.
If I was defrauding anybody, I would be in prison by now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so even the FBI agents told me there was nothing they could do because of the statute of limitation. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, all the evidence, where is the evidence? And I was so glad when Epstein got busted.
I was just about to ask that because, I mean, we've only got you for a few more minutes. And moving into the world of modern trafficking, that is really one of, and even to hear now that, like, they're actively trying to serve papers on Prince Andrew. Like even to hear that Bill and Melinda Gates she went and talked to a divorce attorney the day that Epstein was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
That was phenomenal to hear.
Yes.
Because of his relationship with Epstein. And
yep.
How they knew each other and things like that.
Yep.
So, what has that meant for you? And what has it meant inside the movement? Because, I mean, despite any foolishness of the last man to hold executive office, the one executive order that he signed that was like, good God, thank you, was the Human Trafficking Rights Act. And the,
yep.
and the fact that there is actively now a means by which to compensate people who have been through
yep.
that kind of
human
trauma.
Absolutely.
And to have their story told, to have this come out to life. Like, the fact that people don't even realize the man passed that into law is mind-blowing.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what have these things meant for the community, for those of you that have been trafficked?
To me, I feel like there's still, because I also know some of the men that Epstein hung out with.
Sure.
Because I went to New York, I was in California, I was in all these other places. Now, I saw Epstein from afar. We never got chummy. He was into blonde-haired girls. But it depends on who he was hanging out with. So if a millionaire or billionaire during that time says, I would rather have black girls, he will go and find black girls too. That's not being talked about. We're still having on the media the pretty blonde hair, blue-eyed girl.
Yeah.
When there are other ethnic groups and other races that are being trafficked. That's where I feel like the advocate for
it's where
those
90%.
Yes.
Again, because blonde hair, blue eyes is only 10% of the world.
Exactly. Folks. Exactly.
I hate
you know,
to give you
but
the
I was glad
ratio.
That he was exposed
yeah.
because I've been talking about corruption. Yeah. I've been talking about corruption since the moment I first started yeah. speaking, which was in 2003.
Yeah.
And when I was on Montel and Tyra Banks and all these others, Huffington Post,
yeah.
I told them about the level of corruption. And everyone's like, oh, really? There were politicians. There were celebrities. I can't say the celebrity's name. Yeah. But there were celebrities
well,
that were
right
involved.
As I met you was right up around the time that the, quote, Pizzagate
yes.
and everything else was coming out. And,
yep.
You know, whether or not you go into Pizzagate and that pizza parlor
yep.
or anything else, the real crazy, horrible fact is that the Democratic Party never denied any of the rest of it.
Yep.
any of the rest of the corruption, the
yep,
the trafficking, anything else was never denied. The pizza yep parlor was.
Yep.
But the rest of it wasn't.
Exactly. They would deflect on it. They would deflect on it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
They would deflect on it.
It That's was literally a point of deflection.
Yes. You know, whenever I had people ask me, they said, I'm just curious, what is your politics? And I tell them, I'm
what
not partisan.
What politics? You're all right. Horrible.
Right? Thank you.
I'm a human being.
Yes.
That's what I am.
Exactly.
I don't know what you are,
exactly,
but I'm a human being.
I voted for the green woman, the woman that wanted to be independent and green.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't vote for either side.
Seriously.
I'm like, nope. Because the amount of corruption you see when you're being trafficked,
yeah,
it's scary. They're scarier than the mob. That's why the mob would rather be in witness protection.
The mob's got some rules, man.
Right? You don't cross here.
Yeah.
You don't do that.
Yeah.
Or you're going to get, you know, something coming to you. And they give you
yeah
one
hey
warning.
Wait, that's a kid. Hell no, bro.
Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, so I was glad when he was exposed because it felt like it validated my story. It validated the
yeah
level of corruption, the
yeah
elites, and everyone that was involved, you
yeah
know? And then now they're coming out with the Illuminati. They're like Jay-Z and Beyonce's part of the Illuminati. And I always tell people, I said, unless you bring in some type of evidence, then I will help you investigate further.
Yeah.
But right now it's nothing but a social media buzz.
Yeah.
And I haven't found anything.
Yeah.
You know? And then also they're talking about the masonry, you know, and all this other
stuff. I'd love to hear about all that. I would love to even explore that road. But it's one of those, I got an invite on a Facebook message to be part of the Illuminati. So I don't think that's where it's at.
Exactly.
I don't think that's what's happening.
Exactly.
I got a Facebook message.
So exactly.
No, I'm sorry.
Exactly.
I don't make that much money. It cannot be the in elites.
Exactly.
If I got a Facebook message.
Right.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
There's that. And, you know, I'm not going to say that those movements didn't exist. I'm not going to say that within any movement there is not a cabal. I mean, I went to the Catholic seminary literally two exits up the road from where we're at.
Yep.
To say that there is not a cabal within the Catholic Church that...
I grew up Catholic myself.
Priests that touch children,
yep,
nuns that touch children, what have you.
Yep.
Absolutely. And the horrible thing is, to be a seminarian, you go through days of psychological examination.
Yep.
Days. Chong. Days.
Yep.
And if you can pass those exams, you're already like that level of sociopath.
Yep.
Like, you're already that level
That's
of sociopath. And you're getting into that
yep
because you're that level of sociopath, and
yep
you want to hide behind that.
Exactly.
Like,
yep.
So,
and that's what makes them great groomers.
And that's already within that deviation of humanity.
Yep.
Whether you're a teacher, a cop, an archbishop, a mayor of a city, it doesn't matter. That deviation of deviant mind of humanity is within the populace.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't take a collar to make you that way. You're
exactly
already that way when you get the collar.
Absolutely.
You're already that way when you get the badge.
Mm-hmm.
You just got a different level of access now.
Absolutely.
And that's what I think people don't really understand. That's where I think, unfortunately, society has such the utter backlash that they aren't willing to find the middle ground and actually tackle the problem.
Yep.
You know, they're so willing to go through blind rage at faith, blind rage at the pillar of society or like, for instance, do you hate police officers?
I don't trust them.
Okay. Fair enough. That's more than a fair answer. Like, I don't trust a lot of them that pull me over.
Exactly.
I know my rights now. I spent a night in jail because I didn't know my rights.
Yep.
And I did what I was told to do my whole life,
yep,
which was cooperate with police officers.
Yep.
And the first thing that happened that my lawyer said was, so how'd that work out for you?
Right. And how they always say, if you call a lawyer, you must be guilty. No, I'm going to make sure of my rights.
No, right now, you can take the time to call my lawyer.
Yep.
Here's the number.
Exactly.
You call him. I'll wait.
Exactly.
Because I'm drunk, right? Lord knows I don't want to misdial. You call him. Feel free. It'll be fun. Put him on speaker. Like, do whatever you got to do. But don't call. No, don't. It's their job to find a case.
Yep.
So
they're fishing.
So your distrust of it.
Yep.
I don't doubt.
I distrust the system.
but if you were in a moment of need and in a moment, would you go across the street to the police officer that's there?
That depends on the situation. I mean, yeah. You go Vogue.
Sure,
Rogue.
Sure. Yeah, it's one of those. You don't just throw away society because of the minority.
That is true.
You know,
that is true.
You
I
can't.
Mean, I've called cops
yeah, sure.
whenever I needed help because I was in Houston helping a 13-year-old girl that was being trafficked, and I had to call the cops. And I need their help because this stupid pimp was waving his gun. Like, stop shooting. And I was like, first of all, he can't shoot. He's like doing this.
Yeah.
Are we up there in the sky? Are we flying around?
Well, and that's just it. It's the fact of you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Exactly.
And we have to make sure that we are investigating people's claims, make sure that we are actually looking into people's claims. And the fact, even now, like before COVID happened, I was on the road 35, 40 weeks a year. It got to the point between the time I met you and the time that things happened in that year and a half that I started seeing signs in hotels.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like, do you see this? If you see something, come say something at the register. If something doesn't register, you know, things like that. So there's definitely a movement toward it. What can people do to become more aware? What can they do to raise awareness in their area or to even become more educated on the topic of human trafficking? Other than, of course, reading Broken Silence.
Yes. Well, one, they can hire me to come and teach them.
Okay.
I have workshops. I have webinars. If you want to keep it virtual, we can do a webinar. I made it affordable for everyone to get on webinar. I know some people charge like $150 to jump on webinar.
Yeah.
Mine is only $30.
Wow.
Because I want people to be informed.
That's great.
And so the more people that log on, you know, I can be able to eat. And but one of the things I want to say to parents is that you have to be the investigator of your own children.
Yeah.
Who are they talking to? Who are they chatting with?
Be involved.
Exactly. Be involved. There was a dad. I'll give this quick example. This dad has a 14-year-old daughter. She's been chatting with this guy on Instagram. Now, the father is Caucasian, so is the daughter. The boy that she's talking to is a black boy. And so the dad told the daughter, you're not going to see him. Because to the dad, the boy kind of looked suspicious. And, you know, because he had a bunch of pictures of weed, 420, and a bunch of Benjamins, you know, and all that. So his dad was worried that he might be a drug dealer. So I told the father, I said, don't tell her that. Don't tell her not to see him because she's going to go straight to him.
Yeah.
And I said, you want to get to know him?
Get to know him.
Jump on Instagram, be his friend, learn about him because I bet you anything, he's going to run away.
Lightly stalk the guy. That's what I
Thank
did to you,
you
before you came on my show.
Great. That's how we became friends.
That's all right. I mean, you remember when I was like, don't worry, I did my Google stalking. Like, that was my job at one point. It was like, hey, this guy wants to come on the show. Go check him out. So it was like, spend a day and just deep dive into the universe and find somebody. It's all out there. Like, I remember one day my niece had gone through a friend of hers at school. Had committed suicide. Her and a few friends were really, really down and in a bad way in the world. And I saw her one day pop up on Facebook. And it was pretty rare that I would see anything from her profile rotate through on Facebook. I just happened to see it that day. And she was talking about being really down and sad. And this dude who was about our age. And at this point, I was like almost 40.
Mm-hmm.
Popped onto her page and was like, man, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. That's horrible. If you need somebody to talk to, don't hesitate to reach out to me. I'm always here for you. And I was like,
that's a red flag.
Well, that just doesn't seem like something that a parent would say.
Yep.
To another parent's kid.
Yep.
You know, like, not without, like,
their permission.
Talking to the parent.
Yep.
So I texted my brother, and I screenshotted it with my phone, and I sent it to him. I was like, hey, man, I know Megan's been going through some stuff, and I know she's been in a really vulnerable place. And she talked about some bad things, stuff like that. And I was like, something just doesn't feel right, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he started going through and started doing kind of like what I do and deep diving into his page and started seeing all of his friends. And all of his friends were people that were under 20 years old. And he's like 42. And they were all female. He was like, yo, creeper, get the fuck off my daughter's Facebook page now. I am watching you. Like, straight up. And that was one of my first exposures to, like, wow, that's literally how close to home and how quick that happens.
Mm-hmm.
How quick that happens.
In an instant. That's why I always
male
tell people,
or female.
Yep.
It's the vulnerability.
Exactly.
It's the vulnerability that those pounds are literally haunting for.
Yep. And that's why I always tell people, be careful of behavioral detection.
Mm.
If something doesn't look right,
yep.
You know, follow your gut feeling. Your
yeah.
gut feeling. Quit making excuses for your gut feeling.
Yeah.
Behavioral detection. And some people don't know what that is. So, with that being said, I'm working on two projects.
Okay.
I don't know if we talked about this the last time. I'm wanting to launch a TV series about human trafficking.
We lightly touched on it
yes.
a little bit.
So I also changed name. Last time it was called Save Me.
Okay.
So I changed it to Every 40 Seconds.
Okay,
that
great.
Way it's a catchy
Which
title.
Was the hashtag.
Yes. So I'm still looking for a network, trying to find investors, you know, things like that.
Okay.
And so to get into television, it's getting harder and harder because if you don't know people,
yeah,
it's kind of like it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Who you know.
So that's why I'm trying to find, or I may go independent, go to like Tubi or Plus TV and all those other, because now new networks are coming out.
Oh, sure.
So that's one project I'm working on. So the TV series is actually about me teaching the FBI how to think like a trafficker, and we tackle with every case.
Great.
But I wanted it more like a fictional version. Like it's kind of like Quantico. Have you ever heard of Quantico?
Oh, yeah.
It's like Quantico means Criminal Minds.
Okay.
We don't solve the case within an hour. I don't like those type of shows because it's unrealistic. It is so unrealistic.
So an hour and a half.
Has to be done in an hour and a half.
So much more realistic.
Exactly.
I'm just playing.
But the case actually gets solved at the end of the season.
Yeah.
But a news case comes on to add that cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And so the other thing I wanted the TV series to understand is Camille Flores is the lead character. And so I wanted people to understand how survivors go through things, what triggers us, what is considered a trigger, how our mind works and things like
that. Well, even tonight, whenever you came here, you've been on the show a couple times. We've spent more than, like with any guest, I spend more than episode time with my guests.
Yes.
And there's reason for that.
Yes.
It's so that we can become more than just hosting guests.
Yes.
And to have you come here to my hotel room, even tonight, you brought somebody with you.
Yes.
And when you were like, hey, can I bring a friend? I was like, I guess. And then I followed it up with like, yes, absolutely. I could understand with your past how coming to a strange person's hotel room might just be a trigger moment for you.
And the funny thing is that
not that we haven't talked,
exactly.
Not that we aren't friends on social media,
yep.
Not that we haven't literally texted and messaged back and forth
exactly.
for days on end
exactly.
about stuff in the world.
Exactly.
But that doesn't change it. That doesn't mean that it's not a trigger moment and that it's not something that I shouldn't recognize and be aware of and mm-hmm. be open to
exactly.
and be okay with.
Exactly. So I thank you for that. But Absolutely. It wasn't a trigger moment.
No.
I actually wanted to bring my friend.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same moment, it's one of those, I think people don't
realize
all too often in society, we even here recently, I with my mom had to backstep things by like 30 years and be like, I understand this is what you went through with dad. But understand that him is a 70-year-old man with a zipper scar. This is as close as he can get to caring.
Yep.
And actually being a human.
Yep.
So accept that.
Exactly.
Love that. Be okay with that.
Yes.
Because that's as close as his little scarred self can get.
Absolutely.
And if anything, you need to be compassionate
yep.
to that.
Exactly.
And feel compassion for the fact that calling you and asking if you've heard from the doctors because the doctors aren't telling you anything about your other son. Yeah, you've been divorced from the man for like my whole life. I'm 46.
So am I.
But him calling you to complain about the doctors not calling him.
True.
Is as close as his little injured heart can get to being human
yep.
and caring.
Exactly.
And you need to understand that.
Yes, absolutely.
And you need to understand how close somebody can get, and then that may be as close as they can get.
And you know what the funny thing is? I had one of my guy friends, he said to me, he said, so you like flowers and teddy bears and everything? And I said, actually, it's a trigger. I don't like men buying anything for me because I feel like I'm being bought.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my female friends,
yeah,
that's
daddy.
Where we clash. Because I feel like if he buys me, then I owe him something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that.
Yeah.
And so I always want to be independent. I want to make my money. That way I don't have to owe anyone.
Yeah.
So finding, especially on the male gender, it's hard to find a male gender that genuinely helps you without sexual favors. Expecting,
yes.
wanting, requesting, hoping, without any of that.
Yeah.
That's why I have gay friends. Because they'll help me out, and we don't have to ever talk about sex.
There's nothing looming in the background.
Exactly. So a lot of my female friends, not my friend here, she actually understands, but my other female friends, they're always asking me, they're like, Chong, you need to give him a chance. And I'm like, I want to pay for my own date. He could pay for his. We could go Dutch. And so a lot of men are shocked. Because they're like, oh, I'll take this. They're like, no, I'll pay for mine. You pay for yours.
Yeah.
And
it's okay. You're broke. I got this.
Exactly.
That's what you should do from now on.
But the funny thing is, you know, I kill plants. So I always tell the guy, okay, so on the first date with me, let's meet up at the sports bar. I don't need these fancy schmancy candlelight dinners. Number two, I want to pay for my own meal. That way I can get whatever I want. If I want crabs and lobsters and steak and chow down, I don't have to get a freaking salad.
Yeah.
Two, we're not going to have sex tonight. If we do, I'll never want to see you again.
Or tomorrow. Or next Thursday. Or next Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Or possibly even next month on the first Tuesday.
If you want to date me and impress me, don't get me flowers and candy and everything. Unless it's Dove chocolate, give me the economy size at Costco.
Yeah, you know, the large solid 2-pound chunk.
Yeah.
That one.
Exactly.
That's all right.
Exactly.
Anything
but flowers
else?
And teddy bears. I'll buy my own teddy bear or whatever. If you want to buy me a gift, I want you to get me journal books. I like poetry. I want you to be more into me instead of the idea of being with a female. Because every female is different.
Yeah.
If you give me those things, then that means you were listening to me.
Yeah.
And then we can talk about the next step.
Yeah.
And I'm also triggered by lotion. I hate lotion to the core.
And I can appreciate that.
you know?
I'm sure for
plenty of reasons.
Directly, diametrically opposed reasons.
Exactly. But the funny thing is, I get all of my girlfriends that buy me lotion, and I'm like, so then I'm like, now I actually accept them, because then I give it to my other girlfriends.
Yeah, just re-gift it.
And they're like, oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Here you go.
Oh, you went to Bath and Body Works for me.
Exactly.
Yes, I did.
Exactly. Like, you know, especially my prissy girlfriend. They're like, oh, I love this lotion. You do. I know. You know, I'm more of a sentimental type of person.
Yeah.
I had the one thing that my ex did ask me. He said, what is your biggest sexual fantasy? We were talking about sex.
Sure.
And so he said, what is your biggest fantasy? Because I never had a threesome. He went into threesome. He went into orgies and all this stuff. So I told him, I said, you know what my biggest fantasy is? To really be in love. Because they don't have that in the escort service. They don't have that in strip clubs. They don't have that in nightclubs. You can have any F partner you want. You can bounce it, pop it, twerk it, do whatever you want. Anytime, anywhere, with anyone. But finding love, that's not something that you can find anywhere.
Yeah.
That's my fantasy. I want to be made love to, like the way the Boys to Men did that music video. I want the candlelights. You know, that's the only time I'll accept flowers, as long as it's, you know, on the bed and it'll be off the bed. You know, I want the soft music. I want the serenade. I want the candlelight. You know, I don't want the candlelight dinner in a restaurant. I want the candlelight dinner, like, on a patio. Mm. I want him to work hard to think about what is it that Chong wants. Let me learn about her.
Sure.
You know, if I'm pointing out something like, I like this, you know, are you paying attention as much as I'm paying attention to you? If you say you like, you know, drills and tools and things like that, I'm going to buy that for you. If you like jazz music, I'm going to buy that for you. I would just like that reciprocation. You know, don't just give me, you know, a lingerie because you want me to look sexy with a can of whipped cream.
Yeah.
Well, I already did that before with somebody else, so it doesn't feel sentimental to me.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, when we talk about triggers, you know, I think it's first and foremost, it's important for us survivors to also recognize those triggers and be able to vocalize that to someone, because it's not their fault that they don't know. But it becomes their fault when they ignore it after you share.
Yeah.
You know?
When they ignore it, when they minimize it, or when they make fun of it openly in front of you. Even though it may be a passing course of conversation in normal everyday society, that doesn't mean it's not a trigger to you and something that they should not be aware of and accountable for their actions while you are present.
Exactly. And so, you know, with that being said, you know, I had to learn how to vocalize to men whenever I'm dating them. Now, because I went back to therapy because of this whole narcissism, my therapist challenging me to go on dates but not tell them anything about me.
Yeah.
As a survivor.
Yeah.
He said, I believe that men are targeting you to exploit what you went through. He said, let them get to know Chong Kim as a woman.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't know. I was like, am I a woman? You know?
Does that make you feel too vulnerable?
It does. Because all my life, I mean,
is it a different switch for you to flip on?
Yes. It's a different switch because
And that's almost a trigger in and of itself, just to have to flip a switch.
Yes. Because I don't know how to do small talks.
Yeah.
So whenever I have friends that are
here.
Yes, because we can say anything we want. And because you already know me, but I'm talking about like when we do networking parties, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to have small talk. Mm. And sometimes I feel like I'm out of place.
Do you think that's a problem with definition of yourself outside of survivor?
Yes. Because I haven't explore that part. So I'm learning.
Yeah. You're literally still discovering that Chong Kim.
Yes.
That's not the survivor.
Exactly. So when my therapist said, he said, tell me about Chong. And I was like, my alter ego? He goes, no, not your alter ego. He said, what is Chong like in her personal world? That has nothing to do with human trafficking.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, okay, let's start with, does she like to cook? And then the first thing came into my mind, like, oh, I'm a woman, I need to cook. So then that becomes a trigger. And I'm like, and then he looked at me, he goes, what are you thinking? Share your thoughts. And I was like, when I think of cooking, I think, oh, because I'm a woman, I'm expected to know how to cook. And he said, no, I'm just asking just a simple question.
Yeah.
Do you love to cook? And I said, I do and I don't. He said, okay. He said, when you do love to cook, what do you love to cook? And I said, I'm very good at cooking Korean meals because it's something that my mom taught me and I feel proud.
Yeah.
Even though she was abusive half the time. So, and he said, what dishes would you like to learn how to cook? And so he challenged me to watch videos that have nothing to do with human trafficking. So now my awareness on human trafficking has gone behind because I've been watching cooking shows and puppy dogs and kitten videos. Sure. I'm like, oh, they're so cute.
Just following rabbit holes of interest.
Yes.
Imagine that. You know, what the internet's supposed to be used
exactly.
for.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
cat videos.
Exactly.
Totally.
So I'm looking at these videos and looking at these art and everything. And then I realized, you know what? I was watching a paint. Mm. And after I was watching it, I was with one of my guy friends. He was like, you really like those art. You should get into art. When he said that, it brought trigger. So then I was like, nope, I don't want to do art. He was like, but I just saw you watch art videos.
Yeah.
And that brought trigger. And so my therapist says, what trigger did it bring?
Yeah.
And I said, because every time I went through therapy, we always had arts and crafts, arts and crafts, arts and crafts. It was like, oh, we're going to teach you how to heal, so we're going to do arts and crafts. And it was like, oh my gosh, I'm getting sick and tired of arts and crafts. Can I just get a gun and just start shooting bad guys? That'll make me feel good.
My therapist used Othello.
Uh-huh.
We played Othello in elementary school. That's what we played. We would play that and pick-up sticks.
Yes.
And we would talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so
it disarms you.
Yes.
When your hands are busy.
Yep.
The hands are busy, the brain just goes.
Yep.
It just lets out. So yeah.
And so then I realized why that was a trigger, but why I had a longing for paint.
Mm.
Then I had a flashback. My mother, when I was 17 years old, a lot of people don't know about this. When I was growing up, I was in a wheelchair. I was born with congenital syphilis. My mother was raped. So she contracted syphilis. Mm-hmm. And so through the development of a baby, I wasn't supposed to live.
Yeah.
Most syphilis, congenital syphilis babies live only up to 1 year. If they pass 1 year, up to 10. So I'm actually one of the very few, if not the only one right now, that has lived past 10.
Wow.
I had doctors tell me, they said, you can fall the next day. You can walk. And in an instant, your bones can give up.
Yeah.
So I have this constant panic. Like, when is my bones going to give out?
Yeah.
When am I, you know, when is that going, when is God going to pull the plug on me? Because I'm like, God, I know we don't get along because you've done a lot of damage in my life. What should we need to talk? You know, please don't pull the plug on me. And, but anyway, going back, I used to stay at this handicap home. And I was in a body cast from here all the way down to my toes.
Wow.
And we would have professors from OU, Oklahoma University, that would come and volunteer and teach art. This one retired art teacher, he actually came from New York. He was from New York for the Julia Art School. And I would sketch. I loved art for the longest time when I was a little girl. That was my escape to my abuse.
Sure.
I would draw, I would sing, I would write poetry. And so he said he told me I had such a talent that he wanted to enroll me to the Julia Art School after my high school senior year. And he said, if you want to go early, I can transfer your transcript and you'll do some homeschooling. He was willing to teach me and everything.
Oh, wow.
And so he bought me worth of $5,000 of acrylic paint, canvases, and brushes all in the combination. I was so excited. And I ran home, and I was like, Mom, I have great news. And my mom looked at me, and I said, and I showed her every canvas. I was like, he got me this canvas, he got me this. And my mom picked up the canvas and burnt every one of them. And she was like, you're not getting out of here. You're going to be stuck with me. And I bawled my eyes out. After that, I didn't touch paint. Wow. I didn't sketch. It's almost like when she killed those canvases, yeah. I died with it.
Wow.
So now my therapist has challenged me to get back into art, but on my own pace.
Yeah.
He said, do you need to drink wine? Do you need to drink a margarita while you're painting? And so I'm still looking at videos, trying to find, and I was like, well, right now I don't have the money. He said, they have grants now. You can actually get grants.
Yeah.
And so I was telling my friend about Polaris Project. Have you heard of Polaris Project?
I have.
Okay. Polaris, I'm part of their Survivors Forum.
Oh, wow.
So I found out they also give grants to survivors for hobbies to help us heal. And so that's what, so I actually applied to get some art supplies. So awesome. I'm hoping to get accepted. But, you know, I just want to share that was a trigger moment.
Yeah.
You know, when I was looking at videos, I was happy looking at videos until he said, you should get into art. And it was like,
that's all it takes. That's all it takes to scratch the record.
Yes.
Literally. Literally.
Yes.
And to start a straight spiral.
Yes.
It can start a straight spiral inside. It really can.
And he was shocked. He was like.
And it's no fault of that gentleman's. It's no.
And I felt bad.
Yeah.
But my action, I will say this much, I was, because of the trigger, I was annoyed.
No, it's like you almost feel bad for your reaction to the trigger.
Yes. I do.
Yeah.
Because when I was flipping and I was like, I don't want to talk about it. And he kept pressing on. He was like, you were watching. And I was like, I know what I watched. Can you just stop? And he just looked at me. He was like,
oh. Yeah.
Okay. And I was like, and then after 5 minutes later, I'm like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to yell at you. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm just fucked up.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what it was at the time.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was a trigger at the time. Yeah. And he was like, and he was lost. And so when I realized it, my therapist said, maybe you should give him a call and say, hey, let me explain. And I was like, do I really? I already said I'm sorry. I don't want to go back. You know, but I did. I called him up and I said, I want to apologize.
Yeah.
I said, it was a trigger for me. And he was like, does a trafficker traffic you with art? And I was like, no, not a wrong trigger. Because everyone thinks all the emphasis is on trafficking.
Yeah.
But there are so many other triggers.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just it. There's triggers to the use, triggers to the abuse. It's a vicious, vicious cycle that feeds upon itself.
Absolutely.
And the fact that you were able to make your way out of it, the fact that you were able to triumph over the adversity and the aftermath, and to be where you are now, and to be where you are with Broken Silence, I am so happy for you. I am so entirely proud for you to have come to this moment.
Thank you.
In the time that I've known you. So. Before we let you go, where can people go to get the book? I mean, of course, other than the Dudes and Beer and Curious Realm store, where can they go to get the book? Where can they go to keep up with you? Where can they go to register for classes? All that good stuff.
Right now my website is down.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to revamp my website.
All right.
But they can follow me on all my social media at I am Chong Kim. At I am Chong Kim.
There you go.
I came up with that that phrase because for the longest time, I had my mother scarred me with the name Chong. Mm. So I was triggered by it for the longest time. I hated myself. Then I was named Julie for the traffickers.
Yeah.
And then when I was hiding myself, I would have people call me Kim.
Yeah.
So then I stopped. Once I started to rebuild who I am and what I want, I was like, you know what? No. People are going to respect me for the name that I got. Yeah. Even though I got it from the parents that abused me, but it's still my name. So that's when I said, I am Chong Kim.
Yeah.
And then I started seeing all these celebrities, I am, and I'm like, did you guys steal from me? Come on, admit I should get the credit.
That's beautiful. Beautiful. So, well, while you're online checking out everything from I Am Chong Kim, buying the book Broken Silence, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer website. Make sure to stop on by our sponsors, Stop on by Curious Realm, everybody. Chong, thank you so much for your time tonight. Thank you so much for everything that you do in the world of human trafficking. It really has become one of the many causes that we have gotten behind with this show. It's one of the things that has really steeled us as a podcast that we've really, really taken up the mantle of. And to know people like you and to be able to help get the word out means a whole lot to us. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow. What an amazing interview with Chong Kim. She is such a candidly open person about such a horrific experience in her life. And to share those details, to be willing to share them in her book, Broken Silence, to be able to even tackle this topic with a morbid sense of humor after the years of torture and torment she went through, personally, spiritually, emotionally, is one of the bravest things in the world. So thank you so much, Chong, for everything that you do in the anti-human trafficking community, as well as everything that you are doing to raise awareness to the plight of those that have been trafficked. Our next guest, folks, wrote the bombshell book, Incident at Devil's Den, A True Story. He is a former state prosecutor, and I bring that up for one reason. Number one, much like Chong, it takes a certain level of honesty to come out in the world with an experience like what Terry Lovelace had, much less the experience that carries on through life, through almost PTSD type symptoms on occasion, nightmares, things that go on even biologically with you when you start finding out years down the line, like 30 years down the line, that there is something inside your body that is not natural. That is the story of Terry Lovelace. And the whole reason that I bring up the fact that he's a former state prosecutor is the risk that he took. And I go into it in the episode, the fact that because you're a lawyer, that brings a whole different aspect to the story that you tell in this book, because for you to come out in that way risks it all. It risks it all. And it's so, so hard sometimes for people to come out with their story, for people to be brave enough with their story, and for him to come out despite his previous job, despite the fact that, hey, you know, defense attorneys could have said, hey, look at what the prosecuting attorney's into. Look at what he's about right now. He's saying he was abducted by aliens. Like, I think maybe we should retry this case. Those are some of the things that can happen. So kudos to you, Terry, for coming out with your story and writing it. Kudos to you on the new second book, Incident at Devil's Den, The Reckoning. Kudos to you on the new book that you are working on. I cannot wait to have you on to talk about that. And thank you so, so much for coming out and having a great evening. We had a chance to hang out, laugh, talk, have dinner, all kinds of stuff. So it truly, truly meant the world to me. Right now, folks, our incredible interview with the amazing Terry Lovelace, UFO experiencer and survivor. We'll talk to him right now.
Welcome back, everybody. And welcome to our guest, returning guest, Terry Lovelace. How have you been doing?
I couldn't be better. Thank you for asking.
I remember when I first came across your book, Devil's Den, True Story. It was remarkable to hear somebody talk so candidly about their experience with something from beyond, and to speak so candidly about how it affected their life later, even your relationships with people. And since then, you've of course come out with Devil's Den, The Reckoning, things like that. But before we really get into the incident at Devil's Den, let's talk about you for just a minute. How did you come to be there that night? What did your retired individual now? What brought you to that point? What brought you to the point of writing the book?
begin with.
Yes, this incident happened in 1977. And I should state that I never spoke about this incident with anyone other than my wife for 20-some years. And I'll get into what was the catalyst for that. But back in June of 1977, my friend and I, my friend came up to me and said, I remember his exact words. He said, "Hey, man, I got an idea. Let's go camping." And we were city kids. I knew I was a city kid. I had never been camping in my life. I pretty much knew that he had never been camping in his life. He was from Flint, Michigan.
Mm.
And I'm like, you know, what brought this on? I asked him, I said, you know, why don't we save the gas money and just sleep in my garage and eat bugs, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of going camping.
Yeah.
So, and I really didn't want to go. I was stationed, I was active duty in the Air Force, E-5 at the time, living on base housing. And right in an Air Force base, west of Kansas City, was a SAC base at the time, with nuclear armed B-52s and a squadron of the Minuteman II ICBM missiles. So my hobby was photography, and there really wasn't a lot you could do on a nuclear base with a camera.
Yeah, not really.
So I wanted to photograph wildlife. And my friend was an amateur astronomer, and he wanted to go somewhere where there was no light pollution. So that's how he came up with this idea. And there was a nice park, actually just a mile from the base, Knobnostra State Park. And, you know, a half a dozen nice parks, state and federal, all around the base.
Mm.
But my friend told me, he's like, you know, we got to go to this place. This place is special. It's got an elevated piece of high ground where I can sit and skywatch, and, you know, you can photograph wildlife to your heart's content. And I was resistant, of course, but the idea really grew on me. And I said, you know, I just can't justify the drive. And he made the point, and he said, you know, sometimes isn't the travel half of the adventure, or words to that effect. I said, yeah, you know, I guess you're right. Let's go, we'll make it a road trip, we'll make it fun.
Sure.
And that's what we did. We packed up a bunch of stuff and went to Evanston State Park, which was about a 6.5-hour drive just on the other side of the Arkansas border.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, long drive.
Yeah.
And we'd agreed that we would dodge the ranger station, not buy a camping permit, and not stay in a campground.
Mm.
And I didn't really understand that, but my friend said, look, you know, he said, I'm going to look to skywatch. And he said, we're going to have lights all around us. We're going to have people to the right of us, people to the left of us. He said, that wouldn't be any fun. He says, let's be real outdoorsmen, right?
Yeah.
Let's go find a spot of our own. So we did. We drove into the park, and we drove as far as we could drive. And the road turned from pavement to gravel to pretty much dirt. And we entered thick forest. And I mean, by happenstance, we stumbled upon this plateau. And it's still there. And the map coordinates are posted, I believe, on my TerryLovelace.com website.
Mm.
And there's some aerial photography of it from Google Earth.
Okay.
And, you know, I never bothered to go back to Google Earth and look for the place when we camped, because I thought, you know, it's got to be covered with 40-year-old mature trees by now.
Sure.
It's not. It's clean cut. It's clear cut.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's they keep it cut. And there's still no paved road, just a dirt road that goes up this steep incline.
And any difference between when y'all went and now as far as regulation on camping in that spot? Is that a regulated camping area? Like, in other words, are they maintaining it as a plateau for people to come pitch tent and have unobstructed view?
Well, I found out in 2017 that where we camp is it even a part of Devil's Den State Park?
Oh, wow.
It's federal property. It's owned by the U.S. Government Bureau of Land Management and leased to a private individual, which is just kind of odd. And there's a few, from the aerial photography, you can see there are a few more buildings in the distance around the periphery. But it's still, we trespassed to get into this place.
Sure, sure.
We drove around the chain. There was a chain across the road. Sternly worded sign, no admittance, keep out, hunting, camping, fishing, whatever.
In a very shallow ditch.
Actually, you know what that was?
I've been there.
Park rangers are, I guess, like all of us, a little lazy. And what they did was they took the chain and they looped it around itself and padlocked it to make like a noose, and they just draped it over the opposing post on a nail, right? So my buddy says, I was going to turn around. My friend says, no, I got this. He hops out, he picks up the chain and drops it, and we cruise right on in.
Wow.
And the plateau is, I'm not sure how high it is, but I'll say this, the top of the plateau is level with the treetops of the surrounding forest. So it'll give you an idea how high it is.
Wow.
In my book, I described it as being horseshoe-shaped because we walked around the perimeter. And from aerial photography, it's pretty much a triangle.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
And were you able to, you said that there were some buildings off in the distance in the periphery of the area. Were you able to identify, like, what they were, like a farmhouse?
They didn't look like residential homes.
Okay.
They looked like maybe we're a park, we park its vehicles.
Or something. Oh, sure, sure, yeah.
So I'm sure that's where they keep the tractor.
Like the exterior building, something like that.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think even more interesting, like you said, is the fact that it was BLM property leased to an individual.
Yes.
That's pretty wild. Which, of course, I mean, you would be able to look up and know how to look up, being that you were a lawyer in your previous life.
Yeah, but you know what? Having at least a private individual takes it out of the realm of a FOIA request.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So I can't file a Freedom of Information Act request and say, what are you doing with this property? Mm-hmm. Why do you clear cut the top of this? Why have you burned gas over 50 years to cut the grass on top of a plateau in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, wow.
I'd love to ask them that.
So they clear burn the top as well to keep grass from growing?
They don't burn it, but they keep it cut 6-8 inches tall.
Mm.
I posted pictures of it on my Facebook page, which is ill-maintained, but I had a friend down in Alabama who owns a landscaping business. And he blew up the image, and he says that's cut, quote, with a brush hog, which I never heard. Say again, I don't know what a brush hog is.
Yeah, yeah.
Conjures up a weird mental image, but...
Yeah, it's like a big standing mower.
It's a huge lower deck that you haul behind it, like a farm tractor.
Yeah.
Because he said he could see farm tractor tread marks in the grass and signature cuts of a brush off.
Wow.
So somebody is paid to go up there and cut that.
And maintain it in an industrial way. It's not like somebody's doing it with a riding lawnmower or something along those lines.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. Now, since then, where did that? Let's start getting into the incident itself real quick. I don't want to dwell too much on it because you, of course, go into it in great detail in your book. But I think it's important for people to understand what happened so that they can understand the aftermath.
Yeah, I'd love to share that. I would. Once we were past that chained off portion of the road and we knew that we were into what we thought was a nature preserve, we were euphoric. I mean, we were like, woohoo! I mean, we felt like Lewis and Clark, high fives. And we stumbled upon, just by happenstance, we stumbled upon, because the road went, there were many turns it could have gone. And my friend, I would ask him. He was always the navigator. We drove an ambulance. That's what we did. We were EMTs. We worked at a hospital and drove an ambulance. I always drove, and he was always the navigator, because this kid had an unerring sense of direction. Now, we're going to a place he's never been to before. But he called about a half a dozen right or left turns, and boom, he took us right there. You know, in retrospect, over the years, I've always wondered, how did he know that? I mean, that defies, laws of chance and probability.
Sure, sure. You know, that's interesting. That's where you ended up landing out of all places.
Yeah. Right at the base, and we drove up and crested the hill, and this big open meadow opened up in front of us with, you know, late blooming wildflowers and grass about so tall, and it was just gorgeous. It was just a beautiful place. And I wanted to camp directly in the middle of this meadow. And my friend said, no, we got to camp on the side by the tree line. And I didn't really understand his objection. And usually when Toby and I would argue, he would cave. But he didn't cave. He was like, no, man, we have got to go over here. I'm like, all right, whatever. And in retrospect, had we stayed, set up camp where I wanted to, the thing that we saw would have been directly over our heads. And as it was, because we had parked and set up camp by the tree line, we were offset.
Yeah.
And I'll get into that later and say why that's important.
Well, what was the experience like for you as far as, I guess, literally, the experience? I know sometimes, like myself, with my experiences with the paranormal, sometimes it can be really hard to, I guess, coalesce between what I was feeling and what was happening. And find a differentiation between the two.
Yeah.
Which can make it really hard to explain sometimes to other people. Especially the fact that So it can be hard sometimes to differentiate between the experience, the moment, and feeling. What was it like for you during the moment of seeing this object in front of you?
I'm so glad you asked that, because that's one of the harder parts of this experience to share with people, because it's, in a lot of ways, it's so outrageous, but it's true. And I've heard this from other people who've experienced the same thing, the same phenomenon. And what happened was, we did all the fun stuff you do when you can.
Sure.
And we blew up these air mattresses, and we got them set on either side of the campfire. And we were kicked back on these air mattresses. And I remember I said to Toby, I said, you know, I could see the allure in this. I could see why people like this. This is pleasant. And we had a nice little breeze, and it had cooled down. And the crickets and the tree frogs were just, like, insanely loud. So we're having difficulty having a conversation across this campfire. And a few minutes after I said that, the crickets, the tree frogs, stopped. I mean, just abruptly, like that, it was dead quiet. And the breeze quit. And it was just, it felt unnatural to me. And it spooked me. And I asked my friend, you know, of course, like, he's going to know, you know.
Yeah.
Toby, man, is this normal? It got quiet out here. I'm in a hurry. And he says, oh, yeah, you know, we've been laughing and cutting up. Don't worry about the bugs. The bugs will come back. What are you worried about? And a few minutes passed. And he asked me, he said, hey, Terry, were those lights there before? And I'm like, what lights? Because we were really in a remote location, and there were no lights.
Yeah.
The only light that we could see was maybe a dim glow from the campground that was some miles away. And I stood up, because his torso was in the way, And I stood up and took a step back. And on the western horizon, there were three little stars after the tight triangle just above the horizon. And we watched them for a while. And the question that you asked me was, how did this feel in the moment? And that's such a great question because it's so odd, but it's more common than I ever thought. I've got emails from all kinds of people telling me they experienced the same thing. What happened was we were kind of, our emotions were muted. You know, I mean, we should have been, what we were seeing, sure, we should have been freaked out, upset, concerned, worried.
Shocked.
Shocked, yeah. And there should have been a dialogue between us. You know, two people see something extraordinary, the typical reaction is to say, hey man, you seeing what I'm seeing? And
sure.
What are those?
And yeah.
There really was no conversation to speak of. And these three lights, what they did was they rotated like they were on an axis. And they turned about 120 degrees to where the base of the perfect triangle was aligned with the horizon. And then they started to move up into the air slowly. So the answer to the question was, as soon as this thing started moving up, I felt this wave of calm wash over me. And the anxiety that I had about losing the crickets, the tree frogs, the breeze, all of that anxiety is gone. And the best thing that I can compare it to was I had an outpatient surgery procedure once, and they gave me a drug, I believe, called but it had a hypnotic quality to it. Mm. And it put me, Percet is the drug that they gave to me. And I was awake, I was conscious, but I was just in a different place, totally relaxed. I want to cut my arm off, go right ahead, you know, that kind of thing. And that's kind of where I was. And I think my friend was in the same place. As I said, because our emotions were muted, we didn't have this discussion, we just watched this thing. And it was just three points of light that we saw move up into the sky. And while we're watching it, it reached what I refer to as an altitude, a ceiling rather, it reached the ceiling. And then it did kind of this, and at the three points of light, the thing turned over, and the apex of the triangle was pointed in our direction. So we could see three lights in the line. And then it began a descent. And this wave of calm washed over me several times. And I just felt totally at ease.
Interesting.
Yeah. We watched this thing until it cruised in, and it was enormous. And if anyone would like to see a drawing of it, there's a drawing that I made in 1977, about August, that I had saved, just on ruled notebook paper, and I carefully redid it onto some art paper. Mm-hmm. And that drawing is at terrylovelace.com, and you can see a picture of the thing that we saw.
And when you saw that, like you said, you've known Toby. Y'all would work together, and I mean, when you're EMTs together, you may as well have been in the trenches together in war. Like, you see some things, and some things that you definitely talk about over coffee, lunch, stuff like that. Was your experience a shared or carried on course of conversation post-experience with Toby?
No. I don't understand this. This is what happened. And I thought it was unique, and it's not. There's a famous book by Raymond Fowler called The Allagash Four, and it discusses a very famous incident up in Maine with four guys, twin brothers, the Wang brothers, Jack and Jim, and their friends Rack, R-A-K, and I forget the fourth guy. Four of them on a camping trip. And they were in the middle of a lake. Long story short, middle of the lake. They're fishing at night. They got a big campfire going so they can find their way back in the dark to their campground. And they saw what they thought was the moon. And then the moon got bigger and came toward them. And then this light came down and lit up the inside of that aluminum canoe like crazy. And they're scared to death and they're paddling. And next thing they remember, very next thing they remember is quietly and calmly paddling toward shore, and this giant bonfire that they'd made was just embers. You could just see it glow. And they got back to camp, and, you know, there was no discussing, there was no debriefing. Mm. Like I said, you know, two human beings, four human beings go through some kind of, you know, there should be some kind of dialogue about it, and there was none.
But one would think.
One would think.
Yeah.
And I call this phenomenon the band breaks up. And I'll tell you, there's an email address in the back of Incident at Devil's Den. And I said, look, if you've had an experience and you'd like to share it with me, I'd love to hear it. Well, to date, I have 1,800 emails from people.
Wow.
But there's a core group of those emails from about 400 people that describe in detail and very articulately the experience that they had. And one of the, a thread of commonality that runs through all of these is that phenomenon that I call the band breaks up. And a group of friends will see this, something like this, and then afterward, everybody goes in different directions. People move, people relocate. Nobody sends a Christmas card.
Yeah.
And it's just an odd thing because it happens over and over and over again. And if a family of five, let's just say a family of five, witnesses something like this, nobody will talk about it. Nobody will talk about it. And if 20 years later, I got this one though, 20 years later, Uncle Joe brings it up, you know, at Thanksgiving dinner and says, hey, does anybody remember that saucer we saw in the sky?
Mm.
Everybody is just stunned.
Yeah. And with you and Toby, was the experience something that, like you're saying, separated y'all and I guess drove a wedge between y'all as friends and co-workers?
It did. And it really didn't matter so much because the Air Force separated us, and they sent him to Japan at light speed. And, you know, Robert Hastings, who wrote UFOs and Nukes some years ago, Robert Hastings has talked to thousands of military people who've had encounters. And he told me that that's common. They separate the two of you, or three of you, or four of you, and send you in different directions. And
Sure.
But, you know, on the way back to base, we, when this experience concluded, we were scared to get out of the tent. But we darted from the tent, got to the car, we left all our stuff there. I took my wallet, my keys. My friend left his backpack, his nice Coleman cooler. We left everything. We didn't care. We just wanted to get out of there, you know, with our lives. And on the way home, we made it a pact. We made an agreement that we would not tell anyone that we saw, you know, a UFO the size of Walmart. You know, because we were very afraid that we'd end up on the sideboard. And that was a legit possibility.
Sure.
And, you know, Toby and I both, the military wasn't a career for us. It was a ticket to a college education, period. And we didn't want that. You know, I had a little over a year and a half left on my enlistment, and Toby had, you know, less than a year. So we wanted to finish out our get our honorable discharge, get our GI Bill, and get out of there. So we didn't want to endanger that. So, and we never admitted that. But in answer to your question, on the way back, I sensed something different between us. You know, our lives, we were both newly married. Toby's 23, I'm 22. And our wives are best of friends. Toby had a couple of little kids that were like our kids.
Wow.
And on our days off, we'd barbecue, we'd play volleyball, we'd do something.
Yeah.
And those days were over. And I felt, and I couldn't reconcile that feeling, but I felt on the way back, I don't have nothing to do with this guy. I don't know where that came from, and if I'm your friend, I'm a good friend.
Do you remember being scared or feeling any feelings of uncomfortableness while you were witnessing that on the ridge with him? Or
no, because we were under that sedated feeling. We both felt that sense of calm wash over us. And the thing at park stopped, if you will, 3,000 feet, I'm guessing, right over that meadow.
Mm.
And because we had set up camp kind of off to the side, we could see the side of this thing. Had we set up camp where I wanted to set up camp,
you'd have been directly underneath it.
You'd have been directly underneath it. And I would want to be able to set up.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I've thought about that over the years.
Because I mean, I've talked with you for a couple hours now. I like to think I'm a pretty decent breed of people. But even what you just said, there was fear in that, Gary.
There was fear. There was fear.
And it's interesting to know that even to this day, you're afraid of that approximate moment inside.
I left with a lot of fears that I didn't have prior to that. I mean, I'm 67 years old. I sleep with a lion. You know? I have a fear of being out in the open. I won't cut across an open field. I'll walk a mile and a half around rather than cut across because I feel vulnerable. So, I mean, there are PTSD-like things that I'm left with.
Yeah.
That I recognize that I can trace back to this event because it didn't exist before that.
Yeah, triggers.
Triggers.
And was there any lost period of time? Because I know that's... especially like what you were talking about with the Allagash incident, that was a big part of that, was literally missing hours of time, like multiple hours. They all remember just vanishing in time.
You know, I think we went to sleep because what happened was we saw this thing come to a stop over our heads, and it shot down some crazy lights. And then that sedated feeling abruptly transitioned into sleepy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a distinct difference between the two. You can be sleepy or you can be, you know, sedated and kicked back, but not necessarily sleepy. But I was sleepy. All I wanted to do was go into that tent, lay my head down on that air mattress, and go to sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, I was driven to do that. And my buddy was already ahead of me, and he went to our little tent, he threw his air mattress in, and was on top of it. By the time I got there, he was already snoring softly, and I didn't bother to take off my boots, my shirt, nothing.
Wow.
Threw my air mattress in, and I fell on top of it, and I was just out. As far as missing time goes, yeah, there was missing time. Because I have some recollections of being inside that thing. Not a lot.
Yeah.
Some. So, but I can't account for all of that time. I don't know.
But with that being said, especially with the evidence that was put out in the Devil's Den Reckoning, the photos that you've added to Devil's Den, everything else, you have definitive proof of the fact that something happened to you that night. Whether or not you remember missing time, like you said, you remember bits and pieces of possibly being in a craft, but something physically happened to you that night. Let's start getting into that.
Yeah, what happened was I never had any intention of telling anyone this story. I never had any intention at all of going public.
I can't imagine that you would. I mean, you were, A, in the Air Force, and obviously with some clearances working on a nuclear base. And later in your life, you were a lawyer, things like that. So you definitely, I mean, come on, that anything like that would be a prosecutor's dream.
Yeah, I mean,
to be like, yeah, come on, the defense attorney was like abducted by UFOs. Come on.
I was an assistant attorney general working for an elected official. And I can tell you that would not have gone over.
No.
And that's why I never trusted a soul to take them aside and say, this happened to me back when I was in the Air Force.
Wow.
And that was okay. I was comfortable. Just my wife and I shared this secret. And our kids didn't even know. My kids knew that Dad would have screaming nightmares once or twice a year. You know, had some funny quirks, but that's all they knew. So.
At what point did you find out, and at what point did you know that something had physically happened to you night? No, that's okay.
What happened was I retired from the state of Vermont as state's attorney in January of 2012. And my wife and I moved to Dallas, Texas, where we reside now, because this is where our two adult children and our grandkids are. So that's where we wanted to be. And excuse me just a moment. Allergies.
I can appreciate it. You moved to Dallas.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I retired in January of 2019. I retired in January of 2012. And we moved to Dallas in 2012. And I did all of my medical care from the VA. October of that year, I woke up and I couldn't bear weight on my right leg. And it hurt. And I told my wife, I said, I don't know what's up with my knee, but I need to go to a hospital because I need to go to the VA and have an x-ray because something's wrong with my leg. And she took me to the VA hospital in North Dallas. And I went in and waited my turn, you know, and finally got in. I saw a PA who seemed very knowledgeable and examined my knee and said, well, let's get an x-ray to see what's going on with your knee. And I hadn't suffered any trauma. It's not like I fell or was in a car accident. You know, there was no...
not an avid basketball player.
Not anymore, yeah. You know, I had no causation. And I got rolled into the x-ray room, and the x-ray technician was very busy. She put me up on the table and she took two shots of my right leg, one from head on and then one with my knee,
turn,
at an angle.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see it from the front, you could see it from the side. And she took a couple films, and of course everything's digital now. And she came out and she put new cartridges in and said, can we get a couple more? And then she asked me if I'd had a shrapnel wound or something to account for a piece of metal in my leg. I never left Missouri. I mean, the only thought I had was mosquitoes in Missouri. That was it. And she said, well, there are some, quote, anomalies on the film. I'd asked the radiologist to come down. And the radiologist came down and was obviously... not happy being called down. Because the normal flow in a hospital is, if you're in an emergency room, they take a film of your body, and it goes in, unless there's something there that's obvious to the ER physician that needs immediate attention, that goes into a stat, and then a radiologist will read it and then issue a radiology report in 3 to 10 days, somewhere in that time frame. So it was unusual to have a radiologist come down. And a radiologist came down, and he came over. He looked at the film, went over, poked me in the knee, and said, "It'll be right here." And I said, "What'll be right here?" And he said, "You got a scar right here." And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Yes, you do. You have to." And he showed me the image on film, and I was, I was shocked. You don't need an MD behind your name to look at this film and see that there's a square structure the size of a fingernail with two wires attached embedded in my knee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was stunned, you know. I'm like, "What is that, Doc?" And he said, "I don't know." And the doctor was visibly upset because he insisted on examining my knee and I had no scar. And he said, "The only way for an object of this size, a structure like this, to get inside your leg is with an incision and an insertion." And he said, "I can't account for how this thing got into your leg." And
wow.
When he said that, I knew that it was from them. I don't know if it was from 1977. It could have been from 1967, 1957. I don't know.
Sure, sure.
But it's not organic to my body. I know that. Doctor knew that. And then below my leg, there's a floret pattern about the size of a silver dollar that's a collection of bone in a floral-like pattern with a little dot in the center. And the doctor said, I don't know what this is. He says, "I occasionally you'll see calcification within a muscle."
Sure.
But he said, "I've never seen multiple items of calcification, much less arrange themselves in a symmetrical pattern." He said, I just have nothing to account for this. He said, "I can tell from the x-ray that this is what appears to be bone tissue. It's not foreign matter, it's bone." But he said, "I don't know what's going on with it."
Wow. That is, and was that the end of the exam? Did you ever have anything taken out? Anything like that?
Oh, that's a long story. But I can make it a little shorter.
Sure.
But, you know, when I saw this film, I wanted this thing out of my system. I wanted it out of my leg today.
I'll bet.
And I made an appointment to see a surgeon, a VA surgeon. And, of course, he had my x-rays right on his laptop. And he pulls up the x-rays, and he's like, "Cool, yeah, I'll take these out." And I insisted that we do it under a forensic protocol. In other words, passes from his hands to somebody else's hands who initiates, you know, initials the signs, it dates it, puts the time down, and then passes to me or to whoever my designated agent is inside the operating room. It's the same procedure they use when, like, we're taking out a bullet wound.
Yes, yeah.
So he said, "Yeah, no problem. We can do a forensic protocol for you." And I said, "Great." And he said, "There's only one issue. You've had a heart attack and a coronary artery disease and a pacemaker installed and a stent installed." And he said, "I need a clearance letter from your cardiologist authorizing us to do the procedure, that it will be safe." And I thought, that was a little bit worrisome, but I thought, I can talk my way into this like that.
Sure.
I went and I saw my cardiologist, who knew me, and I said, she saw the x-rays, and I said, "I want these things taken out of me." And she said, "Well, how long do you think they've been in you?" I said, "1977. And she says, "Well, we have a problem here, and that is that the standard of care in this country, medically, is a risk versus benefit analysis. And if these things have been in your body 40 years, and you've not had any problems with them, I can't authorize the surgery." And I got angry. And she said, hey, look, you know, I got about 1,000 vets who got metal in their body from Korea. And they wanted out yesterday, too. Yeah. You know, Korea, you know, Afghanistan, wherever.
Yeah.
But she says, no. She said, if it's not causing a problem, then let it lie.
Yeah.
So that was the problem that I ran into.
Wow. So as of this date, you still have this inside of your knee and in your lower leg?
I have inside my lower leg, undisturbed, is that fluorescent pattern of bone. Above my knee, and this needs a little bit of a backstory. In the third week in October of 1977, I was writing this book, Incident at Devil's Den. And I woke up that morning, and I had two wounds atop both of my legs. And I believe the photographs are in the book, and at TerryLovelace.com. I had... And the things in my right leg are down here by my knee. So I didn't understand. I woke up with these, well, the bruises hadn't come out yet. I woke up with a puncture wound at the top of both of my legs. It didn't bleed. There was no blood. And I could take my fingers and pry this puncture wound apart and see, you know, that deep into my leg.
Wow.
And I knew that they came and they took the skin out of my leg. I knew that. I didn't know why I had that wound on my left leg unless I had something on my left leg I wasn't aware of. Because I'd never had that leg x-rayed. I never thought about it. And I told my wife, I said, I think they came and they got their merchandise out of my leg. And she says, well, you got to go get an x-ray. Okay, and I thought, well, you know, how do you do that? I mean, you can't just walk into a freestanding radiology clinic and say, I need an x-ray.
Yeah, you got to have a doctor's order in order to get an x-ray.
Yes. So what I did was I printed off on my computer copies of my x-ray to show these items, you know, above and below my knee. And I took them with me. And I thought, I'll try a chiropractor's office. Because I know these guys take a lot of x-rays. I know they look at 100 x-rays a week.
Sure.
So I went to a chiropractor's office near Dallas. And I didn't have an appointment, and they were very busy, and she said, you know, he'll agree to see you. Where's your pain? I said, right up here. And she said, okay. You know, unusual questions, been in a car accident, no, nothing like that. And I waited about 45 minutes, and I got to see the doctor. And I'm going to be absolutely honest with the guy. And I pulled on my pants, and I got these puncture wounds that I woke up with. And he looked at me and he said, Bishop, how did you get those? And I said, I don't know. I went to bed last night, I didn't have them. I woke up this morning, I had them.
Wow.
And I said, Doc, I'm going to be absolutely honest with you. I had some anomalies on x-ray in my right leg that I think are implants from aliens that I may have received in 1977 when I was abducted. And I think they came and they took these things out of my leg last night. And that's the genesis of the puncture wound. And he's like, oh, okay then. I don't think we're going to be able to help you today, you know. And I...
Sounds like the problem solved then.
Yeah, I see. Things are crazy, and I don't blame him, you know. So I put on my pants, and he has me by the elbow. He's escorting me to the front door. But you know, I knew these guys had got 100 x-rays a week, and I took those two pieces of paper and I stuffed them in front of his face. And he stopped about 3 feet from the door, and he took the pieces of paper from me and said, follow me. He went into his office, he shut the door, he locked it. And people are knocking on his door, and his phone's ringing. And he puts the papers down on the desk, and he says, tell me about these, the capsule version. So it's pretty much what I said, Doc. I said, I need an x-ray to find out that they did or didn't remove this thing from my leg. And he said, well, I don't have radiology equipment here. I always send people to the clinic down the road. And this blew me away. He said, I'll give you a script for an x-ray. And he said, I'll pay for your x-ray. But you bring it back to me, and you promise when you write your book not to use my name or the name of my clinic. And I honored that promise.
Wow. I
appreciate it very much. My guess is this guy has seen this before, because he wasn't shocked.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty remarkable that's pretty wild to hear a doctor say something along those lines. And even to order the x-ray.
Yeah, and I have those x-rays in my desk to this day.
Wow. Now, what has this led to in your life, Terry? What has this experience done to your life? Has it?
You know, what it did was, I think I had come to a place where I was kind of at peace with it until 2012, when I saw these x-rays. That seemed like it just opened the door, and the nightmares that I have only occasionally just came roaring back. And I felt the need to tell people this, because I know that this stuff is real. And a lot of people don't believe that. And that's okay. I'm not out to change anybody's mind.
Sure.
But I do want to tell my story. Anyone that's interested can listen to it. And I think it's important that there's some kind of dialogue and we talk about it.
Well, I think more than anything, that is what the recent revelations in our society brought about. The recent UAP report, things like that. And granted, on my show, I've talked numerous times about my hold, Terry, is the fact that, yes, absolutely, life exists. I do not doubt the fact I am a believer of believers, but because I'm a believer of believers, that means that the evidence must be greater for me. Like, that's my mentality.
Sure, there's a threshold.
And right now, with everything in the UFO and UAP community, for me, I think it is being done as a point of soft disclosure, because the only way that we will be able to explain the next technological leap is where some of this stuff came from to begin with. And whether or not what we're seeing on those videos is from somewhere else is really irrelevant. It would be great if they were from somewhere else. Maybe. I don't know. Who knows what the intention of someone from somewhere else would be. And there are many great scientists, Stephen Hawking being one, even the great Carl Sagan was like, we need to be careful. Because any civilization that could travel that far or do anything like that, like, they would definitely be far technologically advanced from us.
Yeah, Carl Sagan made a comment about the SETI project.
Yeah.
He said, we're shouting into the darkness.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and even, you know, I Love Lucy, things like that. There's literally been a constant beam of data since the day we started broadcast. It has not stopped.
That might speak.
And it's going out there as a nonstop, constant beacon. And we have to think about that. Like, as a society, we have to think about that. And it's hard. It's not an easy conversation to have. It's a conversation that makes most people uneasy, because I think that despite any religion they may have that bases their life, any faith they may have that bases their life, this goes 18 steps beyond that.
No, it does. And I don't see any conflict between religion and this. I don't understand people that say, I have to choose one or the other, and I choose my God. It's not that kind of decision. I mean, God made a big universe, and
even the capital C church, Catholic church, has come out and said that there would be no issue with Catholic dogma or teaching or doctrine if we found life from somewhere else.
And you know, there's some very interesting...
It would only further expound upon the greatness of God and his power and everything else, which is really interesting.
Well, you know, the Pope has a private astronomical observatory.
Oh, yeah.
In the north of Italy.
Castel Gandolfo.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there since the 16th century.
The University of Dallas, two exits up the road from us right now, has a campus just at the bottom of the volcano that Castel Gandolfo sits on top of. I've been to Castel Gandolfo. I can't tell you how many times walked up to the top of that hill to go see the Pope's Summer Palace and everything else. Yes, where the Vatican Observatory is.
Yeah.
Wild stuff. Amazing. Awesome. But it's been interesting to see them literally step to the forefront on a lot of this. And like I said, for me, the UFO-UAP kerfuffle that's going on in the world, I think if anything has opened the conversation in a new way and opened the conversation in a way that sadly took this long to legitimize the conversation.
Oh, wow. Sure enough.
Some of it I find a little disturbing, especially the quick turnaround of the media to within 2 years of Luis Elizondo coming out with the videos and going on CNN. Within 2 years, media outlets using the term UFO denier. That bothers me a little bit. That just speaks of other things, an intelligentsia, that kind of stuff. And that's where I get the concept of self-disclosure and the fact of we probably have recovered technology. No doubt. Metamaterials, all kinds of stuff would prove the fact that, you know, we've had some incredible leaps in technology, nanotechnology, that kind of stuff. Terry, what do you see, A, for the future of yourself and for the cause of disclosure right now as an experiencer? And because I've had my paranormal experiences in other realms. I've seen what would be defined as a UFO in all sense of the term UFO, unidentified flying object. It was not a silver craft. It didn't have lights. It was nothing like that. So do I say, like, I saw what I believe to be an alien craft? No. I saw some weird stuff up in the sky at like 12:30 at night. It was dark against a dark sky. It was really weird that me and two other people saw. But you as an experiencer, where does this conversation take you and what do you see on the horizon in the community and in the world of disclosure itself?
You know, I don't have time to go into it now, but I will say that I continue to have experiences. And I'll leave it at that. There are two things that I'm looking forward to that are about to happen. And that is, number one, Luis Elizondo is going to release a book soon that you know had to have been fully vetted by all the triple alphabet agencies.
Yeah.
And I had the privilege of meeting Luis Elizondo. He came down to, he spent 2 days with me.
Oh, wow.
Back in 2019, when I was having a weird helicopter thing going around my house. And I gotta tell you, he impressed me. Sitting down talking to him one-on-one, as just one extremely intelligent man. I mean, I don't know how he comes across the television, but he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that, and this didn't really get the press it deserved, but even a week ago, it was announced that the United States is going to open a Office of UAP Affairs.
Yep.
You know, if UAPs don't exist, why do you need an office for UAP affairs? And I think that...
Yeah.
I think we're in for exciting times. What do you do?
It's something I have mentioned on this show numerous times since the beginning is never forget. In 2012, the UN assigned a Secretary of Alien Affairs. They assigned an intergalactic representative.
Yes.
Somebody to galactically greet someone on behalf of the globe.
That's right.
If it happened. And when that happened, as a literal worldwide general consensus that, yeah, all right, we might actually need this. That's something that you need to, despite what any opinion you may have on the UN is, and some of mine aren't right. Despite that, that is major. That is huge, huge. And when you start seeing even folks like Lou Elizondo come out, who, yes, worked in the world of intelligentsia, worked in the world of alphabet agencies, in the world of special access projects, has now moved on to work with to the Stars Academy, who now has funding from special access projects, research and metamaterials. It's hard not to put these things together, you know, and it's hard not to see something on the horizon when you start even just assembling random puzzle pieces and pulling them aside. It's like, oh, wait a minute, there's actually something that's about to go on this table. And it's really interesting to be at this moment right now. What does it mean for you as an experiencer and an experienced survivor to have this moment right now, to have this conversation actively open and out in the open, as opposed to where it was for most of your personal life, most of your career even?
Well, I can tell you I've got a long list of people that I want to call up and say, I told you so. I looking forward to that day to celebrate it. And, you know, I don't know if they're well-intentioned, bad-intentioned. Who knows? I don't know.
Or even if they're all the same people.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, there's 100 different species. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I know this. Whatever the outcome, good or bad, I want to know. And, I feel privileged to have lived this long to see this much. I really want to see our question answered.
Yeah.
You know, I think the average person is so mired down with making a living, paying the bills, you know, doing that, this is the farthest thing from their mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the biggest story of the century.
Yeah.
Right now, we're seeing it happen.
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. And that's something that I bring up in our community all the time whenever I post articles about crop circles, what have you. And somebody will inevitably mention, like, those are all hoaxes. Well, about 85% are hoaxes. There's about 15% margin there that, like, actively have anomalies that even the scientists are like, this is weird. There's an electrostatic anomaly. There's a magnetic anomaly. There's genetic anomalies in the crops afterward that weren't there before. All kinds of wild things. And the one thing I keep telling them is, please don't forget that there was the reaping demon back in the 1500s.
It's like
accounts of these things have gone back to the 1500s. And if you think that somebody in the 1500s had the time and the day, aside from, you know, eating, living, surviving, not getting the Black Plague today. if you think any of those things on the list left time in the day for them to hoax a crop circle and then go tell somebody, guess what popped up in my demon enchanted field over there? You know what I mean? Like almost the exact same thing as you. Like the same repercussions you may have suffered as a state attorney general, having your experience and coming forward with it, that farmer and his family could have very well experienced by just saying, I had this weird thing pop up in my field. Like, you could be driven out of town as a witch. You could be accused of sorcery. All kinds of things.
All kinds of bad things.
Bad things happened all the time back then. So it's like, to think that somebody back then was hoaxing it. Like, they got far better things to do, man. So, yeah, it's interesting to see these topics, to see these things finally coming to light, finally coming out, and finally getting the attention for research that they deserve. Because once again, like we talk about on this show so frequently, the religion of science, I think, keeps so much of this back. And because there is a 10 to 15% anomaly, people are willing to let that go. But at the same time, those same people would gladly go out and spend a dollar on a 1 in a million chance.
That's right.
Of winning the lottery.
That's right.
Or a scratch ticket. Well, or something like that. But they're going to poo-poo a 15% chance of something being a reality if we just look into it and research it with an open mind.
Yes, yes. So, and really, if you look at it from an extreme, all you need is one.
Yeah.
You don't need 10% or 5%.
Yeah.
You need one.
One. One.
One to be real, and you're there.
Yep. And much like any defense attorney will tell you, all we need is one. All we need is one person to doubt this story.
One juror.
One juror.
Yes.
You as a prosecutor had to convince every single one of them. That defense attorney only had to convince one.
Yes. Tell me who had the toughest job.
and tell you who made more money. So, but that is so frequently the situation that we're up against, whether it's the law, whether it's science, what have you. It's the fact that that minority is so just marginalized and ignored and not looked at and just dismissed. And I think it's really good that we have finally gotten to a point in society that we're ready to have this conversation, that we're ready to listen to, like you just said, but sadly, the extremes. But without that extreme conversation, Terry, 500 years ago, we would not have decided that the world was round or that the sun was the center of the solar system. These were things that for thousands of years before then, maybe the Babylonians thought the sun was the center.
Yeah.
And they were right.
but you know, it takes courage to be the one to step
to stand
up
forward.
Say,
Yeah. And, you know, even the American Revolution, less than 20% of the American public, less than 1 in 5 people that lived in America took part in it. But that was able to change everything. That's all that was needed.
Yeah.
So as long as we can stick together, as long as we can literally force the hand of science to investigate, do it.
Yeah.
Do it. We have to. And I think that's part of the big reason I laughed whenever it came out, because, wow, look at this multi-million-dollar 9-page document that they just released on UFOs and UAPs. At the same time, they finally released a public 9-page document on UFOs and UAPs. And that created enough concern to validate the possible need for an office of UAP investigation.
You know, read those 9 pages and count how many times you see the word threat.
Threat. Yeah. Yeah.
There's more in that report. I mean, I
exactly.
It's a legal document. It's written like legislation. It's not written for the average reader to read in a newspaper and digest.
Yeah. It's thick. It's definitely thick with lingo and letters and all that kind of good stuff. So, well, not just like letters that make words, but like alphabet agencies and abbreviations.
Yeah.
Of course the document's full of letters. It's a document. So, Terry, I want to thank you so much for the time tonight. Sit down, talk, taking the time to come over and have this conversation this evening.
Well, I want to say thank you.
Oh, man, absolutely.
Good to meet you finally in person.
Yeah.
I've been on the show a couple times. Always enjoyed myself. It's a pleasure to share this with your awesome audience.
Well, it's been great, and I can't wait to further the conversation. I can't wait to have a conversation upon conversation for many years to come.
Absolutely.
So, one last time, shameless self-promotion. Where can people go to pick up the books? I know you have a new book in the works. As you get that working some more, we definitely want to have you on to talk about it, because the story that inspired it, like, I can tell you right now what my hours in that convention center next door tomorrow will be spent rabbit holing. And it's the story that you were telling me about, because that's pretty incredible.
It is pretty incredible. I'll get into that soon. But Devil's Den, The Reckoning is the second book, and that's available on Amazon in general print. And as an audiobook, and then Incident at Devil's Den, the original book, is also available on Amazon. Both my books are available on Amazon only. Both are available in Kindle, both are available in print, both are available in audiobooks. My website is poorly maintained, but it's terrylovelace.com. Go there and see some interesting photographs. And that's it. All right, that's it.
Well, once again, Terry, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your courage and sharing your story, your experience. It is echoed by so many hundreds of other people out there. So thank you so much for being one of those brave few that steps forward with it. While you're online checking out everything from our good guest, Terry Lovelace, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast, dudesandbeer.com. That is where you can find all the episodes. Make sure to go and Google Curious Realm. That's our call to action. This is officially episode 341. So that makes it 9 episodes away before we change. It just blows my mind that we are that close. So until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.